see in your future Mercury?
A federal government study that looked at the levels of mercury in fish in 291 rivers and streams throughout the country found that in all the samples taken, that's all the samples taken from all of the streams, there was mercury in fish taken from all of these streams in throughout the country. And then in about one quarter to one third of the samples, the mercury levels exceeded amounts that the EPA recommends for human consumption. I should note that while the EPA sets a limit on the amount of mercury that humans should consume, there are many environmentalists and many doctors who recommend a level of zero consumption for mercury, since it is such a potent neurotoxin. So I found that particularly disturbing that there is nowhere in the United States that is safe from mercury levels in fish. And I should also point out that the Bush administration is directly responsible for this as the leading cause of mercury contamination in the food supply is from coal-fired power plants. They've blocked many attempts to limit mercury levels, mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants.
Gonna rise up and take what's there. 'Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
From the Mobile Fortress of Glee Glee Studios, this is This Week in Radical History for the week starting August 24th. Inspiration for this little ditty comes from the Slingshot calendar organizer, and much of the historical radical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history, I only have one item for August 24th, 1967. Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin throw 300 $1 bills from the balcony onto the floor of the New York Stock Exchange to disrupt business as usual. It worked, creating instant bedlam as people scramble for the bucks. Hoffman received a master's degree in psychology from the University of California at Berkeley and is a co-founder of the Youth International Party, YIP, tried in the Chicago 7 trial, author of several books including Steal This Book and Revolution for the Hell of It. He committed suicide in 1989. To quote Abbie Hoffman, "Sacred cows make the best ham."
They sentence me to 20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now. I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
The line must be drawn here.
Yes, I'm a nerd, and for all you Star Trek fans out there, ever wonder in a Voyager series where the term Marquis came from? You know, the underground group fighting against the Federation? Well, the Marquis were the French resistance group fighting the Nazi occupation during World War II. Many of the Marquis were Spanish anarchists who took control of Paris after the Nazis fled on August 25th, 1944. Also, on August 25th, 1950, President Harry Truman orders U.S. Army to seize all the nation's railroads to prevent the nationwide strike to happen. The railroads are not returned to their owners until 2 years later. However, of course, the profits were always returned to their owners. Also on that date in 1968, the Battle of Lincoln Park Democratic Convention in Chicago, with demonstrations and police riots. 10,000-plus demonstrators versus 11,000 Chicago police, 6,000 National Guard, and 7,500 U.S. Army troops, as well as 1,000 FBI, CIA, and Army Navy Intelligence Service agents participated. The world would see what democracy looks like as the government beats and tear gasses the protesters. Lastly, for August 25, 1985, the White House confirms that Ronald Reagan was an FBI informant with his own Secret Service number in Hollywood in the late 1940s while heading up the Screen Actors Guild. How many names do you think this Fink named while he's being paid to protect the actors he's in charge of? This Week in Radical History for August 26th, 1786. Shays' Rebellion, armed insurrection begins in western Massachusetts. armed local farmers upset about the draconian debt laws that often put farmers in debtors' prison and the government taking their lands, host an uprising against the government. For months, they successfully stopped local courts from holding debtors' trials until the government raised its own army and put down the rebellion by force. More rebellion occurred on 1913 in Dublin, as a 1913 lockout in Dublin happens, when tram drivers left their cars in the middle of the road during a bourgeoisie horse show week. Workers around Dublin had horrid living conditions due to poor wages. 26,000 families lived in 5,000 tenement buildings, which gave rise to the highest infant mortality rate in Europe, among numerous other problems. The Dublin factories locked out the workers, who at the end were on the brink of starvation, destroying the union and hopes for higher wages and better living standards. Also on August 26, 1919, more labor unrest. United Mine Workers, UWM, organizer Fanny Sellins is gunned down by company-bought sheriffs during the Pennsylvania coal strikes. She had been a witness to the beating and death of a fellow union organizer. The newspaper report stated, "The mine official snatched the club and fell the woman to the ground. This was not on company ground, but just outside the fence. She rose and tried to drag herself. The official shouted, 'Kill that, blank.' Three shots were fired, each taking effect. She fell to the ground, and the official cried, 'Give her another.' One of the deputies, standing over the motionless and silent body, held his gun down and without averting his face, fired into the body that did not move. One of the deputies picked up the woman's hat, placed it on his head, danced and stepped, and said to the crowd, 'I'm Mrs. Sellins now.'" Lastly, for August 26, 1968, the National Student Association reports 221 major college protests against the Vietnam War held nationwide since January of that year. This Week in Radical History for August 27th only got a couple items. 1927, thousands turn out in violent protests over the deaths of Sacco and Vanzetti in Paris after two U.S. courts find the two anarchists guilty of firebombing in a trial that would give kangaroos a bad name. Dozens of other protests erupt around the world. Also on August 27th, 1988, George Bush Sr. says that atheists should not be considered for U.S. citizenship. Lastly, in 1992, Catholic Church apologized to Indians for the Spanish conquest. Well, better late than never, I guess. A couple years ago, the Catholic Church also apologized for its involvement and support of the Nazis and the Holocaust. And, of course, a couple years ago, the Catholic Church also apologized for the molestation by their priests. How Christian of them. Perhaps George Sr. should have insisted that Catholics can't be considered for citizenship. This Week in Radical History for August 28, 1926, in Nicaragua, for the umpteenth time, Marines land at Blue Fields to protect American interests. On this date in 1927, Ashes to Ashes, as Sacco and Vanzetti funeral is held from the north end to Forest Hills Cemetery. The anarchists are cremated. In September, all Hollywood newsreels of Sacco and Vanzetti are ordered destroyed by William Hayes, Hollywood movie czar. Here is a brief report about Sacco and Vanzetti's memorial held in Boston.
Emperor Norton's stationary marching band provided a contrary festive atmosphere to somber issues of immigrant rights, death penalty, state repression, and the memories of Sacco and Vanzetti.
Well, I'm out here to commemorate the 81st anniversary of the murder of two comrades, Sacco and Vanzetti, and to keep their memories alive. And if their memories are alive, they are.
Why do you think it's important to keep their memories alive?
Because what happened 81 years ago is happening today, all in our streets. Right today in Boston at the Caribbean Festival, where the cops are importing Irish police to conduct surveillance on the crowd goers because of the ICE raids in which our elected officials cooperate.
It was a motley crew of 50 to 60 dedicated anarchists that marched from Copley Square to the streets of downtown Boston to the North End. Red, anarchist, and black flags were waving in the breeze. A large banner of Sacco and Vanzetti led the march. This was the day, August 23rd, 2008, that marked the 81st anniversary of their execution.
I was just talking to a bunch of Italian tourists who were wondering, you know, why do we care about Sacco and Vanzetti? Why are we doing this for the Italians?
That was the question I was about to ask you. Why focusing on Sacco and Vanzetti?
Well, Sacco and Vanzetti are a really, really important part of anarchist history to begin with, but especially the history of revolutionaries in Boston. The Italian anarchist movement in this country was really strong at that time, and we're trying to bring back the anarchist movement to be what it once was and then more. We want a revolution, so great.
Molly Alderstein of BAM. She also works with the Lucy Parsons Center and later addressed the rally at the North End.
An extremely important thing to remember today on the anniversary of their execution is that the case of Sacco and Vanzetti is not some past aberration of our criminal justice system. We can't just look back and remember and breathe a sigh of relief, because this is how our criminal justice system operates. If anything, it gets worse with time, if only because it has become so pervasive that it seems normal now. From 1956 to 1971, COINTELPRO used similar surveillance, disruption, and entrapment tactics on a number of movements, from civil rights groups and the Black Panther Party to socialist and anti-war groups. Currently, to name just a few examples, immigrants, minority communities, and environmental activists are being heavily targeted in the same way. Like in the time of Sacco and Vanzetti, the state uses war in order to scare the general population into submitting to whatever security measures that it deems necessary to protect itself. Then it was World War I, and now it's a stream of never-ending wars, the war on drugs, the war on crime, the war on terror. If we ever get out of Iraq, there's sure to be another country ripe for the occupation. Iran sure is looking like a good prospect. The media certainly doesn't help in making us so afraid of each other that we've submitted to living in a police state. We need to open our eyes and start taking control of our own lives, our own communities, our own media, and our own security. We need to realize that the news on the TV and in the papers is not our own, but a perverted, biased, and censored version of reality designed to keep us scared and in the dark, grasping tightly onto the state, a venomous barbed wire slicing into our hands and poisoning our minds. We can create our own media. There are already projects out there that you can plug into, or you can start your own. If we want to truly honor these fallen comrades, we must continue their work and the work of so many others who are now dead or imprisoned who dare to fight against the exploitation of the state. If we continue the struggle, Sacco and Vanzetti live!
لماذا تركت الحصان وحيدا؟ لماذا And welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on Truth and Justice Radio. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. And this is your host, John Roberts. This week, our Palestinian voice is that of old friend, Professor Mazen Kumsia, who never fails to challenge us with the depth of his political analysis. Today, we feature Mazen speaking to the Jerusalem Fund in Washington, D.C. on May 22nd, 2018. Mazen Kumsia is a geneticist who taught at Duke and Yale universities before returning to his home in Beit Sahor, Palestine, where he continues to teach at Bethlehem University and Be'er Zeit University. He is also the founder and director of the Museum of Natural History at Bethlehem University. Here is Mazen Kumsia speaking on Mayhem versus Sanity in Western Asia, Why Palestine is Still the Issue, in a return engagement before the Jerusalem Fund in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much for coming. I know it's the last day of Ramadan, and for those celebrating the holiday, Eid Fitr Sa'id. I don't want to, of course, I talked last year about different subject. I want to talk today about something that's been on my mind a lot lately with the carnage, especially that's going on in Gaza, that made it fresh in my mind, if you want. Palestinians have paid a very heavy price, of course, since the foundation of the State of Israel, since 1948. Over 100,000 Palestinians have been killed, over 800,000 were injured, and over 700,000 were detained or imprisoned. Just in the past few weeks, as you know, there was over 140 Palestinians who were killed and over 10,000 who were injured, many with live ammunition. Those who were killed in the past few weeks included paramedics like Razan Najjar or, quadriplegic like this guy who lost his legs actually in the previous attack in 2014. It included an 8-month-old baby who was suffocated from tear gas. It included press people, included children, etc. These were part of what's called the Great Marches of Return, which are basically attempts by the besieged people of Gaza to demonstrate that they have not forgotten their homes and lands from which they were expelled in 1948. As you know, Gaza is 2 million people imprisoned, open-air prison, and those 2 million people, most of them are refugees, 70% of them are refugees from 1948. And I thought it was kind of interesting what this artist did with his demolished home in Gaza. But also Israel is using these exploding bullets, if you want, which medically is devastating. They shatter bones, they destroy. So many people lost their limbs in Gaza. Actually, I'm attending a National Geographic conference, and I was talking just today to a guy who made the presentation about 3D printers that print the casts for those limbs. So he said this, we can supply the 3D printer anywhere and we can just take pictures and then create it. So I said this may be an opportunity for us to cooperate and have him do this in Gaza, because it could help a lot of people who are missing limbs and who don't have artificial limbs like they were here. The other thing that happened since I spoke here a year ago, of course, is this spectacle of Mr. Trump and his cronies basically, quote-unquote, moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And I don't want to talk too much about it, but it was rightly described as a American-Israeli colony in Jerusalem rather than an embassy in Jerusalem. But ironically, in the picture illustrates what somebody did with Photoshop, because in parallel, the same day they opened this embassy, so to speak, embassy, by Mr. Kushner and Friedman and others who support the colonial system in the West Bank, there was this bloody carnage in Gaza in which 60 people in that day lost their lives. Many things have happened also since I came here a year ago. As you may have heard also, Ahed Tamimi, a friend of mine who I knew her and her family for past 10 years or 12 years, she was actually resisting when she was 9 years old, and now she's in Israeli jail with her brother and with her mother. And the charge for her mother was that basically she videotaped and put things on Facebook, which I considered incitement. And for Ahed, the charge was that she slapped a soldier who was in her yard, basically, and just they were shooting at Palestinian children in Nabi Saleh. And actually, one of her relatives, her cousin, got a bullet in his head, and he lost, like, part of his skull. They had to remove and reconfigure surgery, etc. And she was so affected by this, the fact that her cousin was hit, that she didn't want a soldier shooting from their yard at other children, and that's why she slapped him. But anyway, she's spending time in Israeli jails for this. Lots of things happen in a year, so to speak. And for me, actually, all the things happen are one pile, and this last 2 days have been another pile in terms of emotional pressure on me. And I'll tell you why. Because the last 2 days there were demonstrations in support of Gaza in the West Bank, and these demonstrations were brutally disbanded by the Palestinian Authority. This to me is much worse emotionally than what the Israelis were doing in Gaza, or which is what you expect colonialists to do. You know, they butcher Palestinians. But for us to have the Palestinian Authority act as a Vichy government, and I'm sorry to use harsh terms, but for example, this is, they dressed as civilians. This is all yesterday, by the way. They dressed as civilians, and they went in beating and dragging people. Many of them are friends of mine. Sorry. But you know, and people photographed them, and now we identified them. We know who they are, that they are indeed Palestinian security services who are doing this. These are the people who are trained by the Dayton, you know, the American training of the Palestinian preventive security, as they call it. So, and even high-level Palestinian officials, there's this gentleman who you see there meeting with Mahmoud Abbas, were participating in beating and arresting people to try and show off that they are really loyal to Mahmoud Abbas. Of course, you know, what alleviates some of the pain is that there's a lot of international solidarity with Gaza. There's a lot of international caring about Gaza, and it's growing. And as you know, there are ships that are going to Gaza. Next month I'll be on those ships going to Gaza. And these ships, four ships that have already toured many ports of coal in Europe, the last ports will be in Italy. And people are very sympathetic to the Palestinian cause around the world. And we'll come back to all of this. I'm just explaining very briefly in the beginning kind of things that happened in a year, upon which I want to then build some sort of analysis, which is very tentative, and I hope that you will help me in the question and answer, that we can focus this to see where we are going. In the medical field, we say it's very, you know, you take a patient history, you make a diagnosis, but then the more critical is to apply therapy, of course. You know, what's a therapy? So that's the part that we will talk about together, because I'm not sure I know all the answers. I don't know, you know, tiny fraction of what might be the answers. There are other things happening in the Middle East which you probably also heard about. For example, there were demonstrations in Jordan, both when they moved the embassy, large demonstrations, and also more recently in the past few weeks, demonstrations about the issues that revolve around the economy in Jordan. Jordan has billions of dollars in debt, and they added $15 billion more in debt by working with Israel to build this canal between the Red Sea and the Dead Sea. I don't know if you heard about that. And this canal is being built on the Jordanian side of the border in Wadi Arab. And the reason it's on the Jordanian side of the border, even though Israel gets most of the benefits, is that it actually leaves Jordan holding the bag of the IMF and World Bank debt of $15 billion for this canal. So the Jordanian public will end up holding this debt. So obviously the World Bank has, you know, like they do in most other countries that they loan money to. There is a book called The Economic Hitman, I don't know if you heard about it, which speaks about how they do these things, so that they subjugate third world countries. And so, yeah, you know, you build infrastructure that the country doesn't need, you loan them a lot of money which you know they cannot pay back, and then you start to force them to do downsizing. Their public rises up, says, we can't do this. So then you say, okay, we'll give you more money, but then you have to do what we tell you to do. And I think this is part of the plan that Trump and his administration have for Jordan, because they do need Jordan for this deal of the century that they are doing. You heard about the deal of the century, which is to liquidate the Palestinian struggle, leave Israel in hegemony over the Middle East, and the issues of refugees. Refugees don't return to their homes and lands. And this is the plan. These are parts of the demonstrations in Jordan. The other thing that happened last week, for example, was in Afula, hundreds of Israelis demonstrated. What they demonstrated for is the fact that there's one house that was sold to an Arab guy, Arab Israeli, and so they didn't want any Arabs in their neighborhood. This is increasingly happening inside the so-called Israeli state. The other thing that happened in the past year is that the Palestinian Authority also instituted gag orders on things, so that they called, because we don't have a legislator anymore, and Abu Mazen was not reelected, so he's de facto become a dictator. So he issued a law that says any posts on Facebook that they deem offensive would mean that this is a crime. So, and they actually arrested a friend of ours, Isa Amru, for a while. And you can see me here demonstrating with the others about this electronic crime law that Abu Mazen, so-called law that Abu Mazen signed. And, of course, you heard that Mr. Trump met with Mr. Kim. Now, why is this also a relevant event? It's because, basically, you know, the message that it sends is an amazing message that I couldn't believe that the United States want to send to the world, which is that, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and if you have nuclear weapons and if you are a threat to the world, we will respect you, we'll work with you. But if you give up your weapons, or if you don't have them anyway, we can knock you down, kill you, like we did with Saddam Hussein and Libya's Gaddafi. This is the message that's sent out now to every tin pot dictator around the world. Get your hands on some nuclear weapons. They will really respect you then. There was a wedding of Prince Harry, I guess. You know, one could spin around that if you want. But there is something that we have to really acknowledge, and I'm becoming more and more aware of it even from outside the United States, and I was aware of it from inside the United States. I lived here for 29 years. And that is the level of disconnect from reality that our leaders have. That our leaders, whoever they are, really think of themselves as somehow, you know, kings of the world. You know, they can move the world, even when they don't have power, like Prince William. they think that they can change the world and that they have a right to change the world to whatever they like. Okay? And this came to mind. We must always think about things, and we must think about things as they are, not as they are said to be by the powers to be, as George Bernard Shaw said. The greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance, it is the illusion of knowledge. And we have a lot of illusion of knowledge around us. But now I want to, okay, now I kind of said to you what I been witnessing in the past year since I came and spoke at this podium last year in March, I think it was. Now I want to think about geopolitics a little bit. And it sounds like a big world and sounds like complicated. It sounds like people like me, who's a biologist, shouldn't even delve in geopolitics because, hell, it's complicated. There's all these players, there's the regional players, international players, etc. But it's really not very difficult to understand the world. The world is rather simple, actually, even though they try to spin it as complicated, but it's really simple. Herzl, for example, is somebody who's, you know, intelligent guy, brilliant guy. I actually wish we have Arab leaders as brilliant as Herzl in terms of organizing and being able to bring people of various backgrounds, you know, leftists, rightists, religious people, non-religious people, atheists, bring them all together under one umbrella and saying, here, let's work for a cause. It doesn't matter what this cause is, but in his case, of course, his case was colonialism, Zionism as colonialism. And he said, you know, a Zionist colony in the Middle East would be serve as a rampart for Western, for Europe against Asia, an outpost of civilization against barbarism. Now, contrast that I think what the outcome happened is very clear. And a lot of what we saw in the pictures earlier are symptoms, if you want, of this colonialism, right? And they are understandable symptoms. I'm not saying excusable symptoms, but they are understandable in the context of colonialism in the same way that you understand what happened to Native Americans here and the butchery of not only the people, but even their livelihood, like 2 million buffaloes that were killed in the prairies, etc. I think colonialism was actually not such a global phenomena as it is today. This may, again, in the discussion, I hope you will correct me, and I hope we can together come up with a different. I think we have colonialism today to a larger extent than we had it 200 years ago, but I think it's a different kind of colonialism. That's all. It's just metamorphosed into a new type, which is economic colonialism, colonialism by proxies. Instead of having British boots on the ground or American boots on the ground, you have proxy governments like Bin Laden or whatever his name is, Bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, that's doing the bids of imperialism and colonialism. That's one point I want to make, and I'm not sure you agree with me or not on this, but I think it's an interesting point of departure or discussion. The other thing I want to say is that when in the past King Leopold killed however many millions of people in the Congo, it was a local phenomenon that, you know, nobody really cared about. Nobody even heard about it. Most Europeans are oblivious at the time to what was happening there. Today, you know, colonialism effect is globalized in the sense that we do have a global community. We do have networking. We do have people traveling by airplanes, you know, from one place to another very quickly, except if they are Palestinians like me. It takes me 2.5 days to get here, and then they question me at every airport, etc., and that's another story. But if it's normal, you fly from Tel Aviv to New York, and that's the end of the story, or to Washington, D.C. So what Arnold Toynbee kind of said in 1961, he said this, by the way, he said is the tragedy in Palestine is not just a local one. It is a tragedy for the world because it is an injustice that is a menace to world peace. And I think he was very prophetic in this, that actually it's no longer local conflict. It's not an issue just for Palestine or for Yemen, for that matter, or for Syria. It is now a global issue. Every issue is a global issue. And this probably started in the 20th century with the globalization of the world and easy communications, telephones, fax machines, and most recently emails and internet and Instagram and Facebook and whatever. Things have become interconnected. And South Africa, we saw, for example, how that was a global struggle, not just a struggle for the people of South Africa, it was a struggle for all of us. I was actually involved in this marginally, actually, when I was at the University of Connecticut in 1980. I invited the speaker, who later I found out was a member of ANC. Of course, ANC was a terrorist organization at the time, as it was described by Ronald Reagan and just about every Western power there is. This is a globalized struggle also because it started globally. You know, the British and the French were the key to establishing the State of Israel, right? In the form of the Balfour and the Jew Cambon declarations, which were parallel declarations in support of the Zionist project. And Balfour actually wrote to his successor in the Foreign Office in 1919, Lord Curzon, saying that basically we don't care whether Zionism right or wrong. We're not interested in that. We just know that this is good for us, for the empire, basically. And so we supported it. So the words he used, it's of far profounder import to us than the wishes and the whims and biases or whatever of the local people. That's the words he used. Churchill. Churchill was a typical imperialist. He was a racist to the core, by the way. One of the worst war criminals in history. Not a war hero, as I like to give him credit for. And this is, for example, a quote from from Churchill in October 1941, which is also prophetic in many ways, is that, after the war, what we will do is create a Jewish state, which will bring in millions of Jews to live in that state, and this will be good also for the empire. There are many examples of this. I want to just go through a few examples of how this is all connected globally in the 20th century, especially with respect to Palestine. After career diplomats in 1930 issued a government-backed white paper suggesting tying Jewish immigration to Palestine to Palestinian economic conditions or interests at the time, and not just to whatever the Yishuv told them to do, the local Zionist organizations, basically. And the reason, by the way, they came up with this white paper is because there was an uprising just before that, 1929, which was uprising number five, Intifada number five. We had, by the way, 14 Intifadas or uprisings. The first Intifada was not 1987. Was 1881, if you want, which was actually successful. But anyway, that's another story. But when they did issue the white paper in response to the pressure from the local people, Weizmann and other Zionists pressured the British government, told them, hey, what are you doing? You forgot about the Sykes-Picot and the Balfour and Jules Cambon declarations. And so the British had to step back from it. This is, by the way, also something that I have debates sometimes with some people in America about, including Noam Chomsky, about, the tail wagging the dog or the dog wagging the tail, so to speak. I think, we have to acknowledge certain facts about this that can be investigated by anybody, really, about the power of the Zionist lobby in Washington, for example, and how it influences and shapes U.S. foreign policy, and not that Israel, as Chomsky said, is like a U.S. Land-based airplane carrier or something to that effect. No, I'm sorry. Israel has more power in Washington than Donald Trump has. When there was a strong sentiment in the U.S., for example, to help European Jews in 1939, 1940, 1941, the Zionist lobby in Washington actually lobbied to close the door against Jewish immigration because they wanted all Jews to go to Palestine. They wanted that. And they succeeded even before AIPAC was founded. Truman, why did Truman support the partition of Palestine, the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine? He said it very clearly in front of his cabinet. All of them were against it, by the way, including all the intelligence services in the U.S., the predecessor of the CIA at the time. All of them were against it, but Truman said, well, I have to do it. And he said in a meeting of these cabinet ministers at the time, gentlemen, and they were all men, of course, white men. I don't have a large Arab constituency who's going to make me a president. He was going to run for president. When the U.S., when Israel just about, 51 years later, but it is the last week was an anniversary of the attack on the USS Liberty and killing of Navy men on that ship in international water, intentionally, by the way, and everybody on that ship swore that this was intentional. And, of course, it was swept under the carpet. So why is it swept under the carpet if it is really the dog wagging the tail, so to speak? We have a slew, and I don't have to tell you this. You know about these things. We have a slew of international figures, important people like Dennis Ross and Martin Indyk and others who basically worked as lobbyists for the State of Israel and then became significant officials in the administration. Martin Indyk was actually an Australian guy. He came here and they speeded up his immigration papers so that they can appoint him as ambassador to Israel. There's things like Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney, and Douglas Faith, and others, and neoconservatives, and how they pushed for the war in Iraq. You can read the book by Mearsheimer and Walt, for example, about why we ended up in Iraq. It wasn't because of oil or because of weapons of mass destruction or terrorism or anything like that. It was because of Israel. This is the reality that we have to acknowledge. A war that cost us, American taxpayers, $3 trillion. There's actually a Harvard economist who wrote a book about this. Called title of the book is The $3 Trillion War. And the U.S. has $21 trillion in debt, of which $9 trillion, to be precise, $9 trillion are due to our wars on the Middle East, on the people of the Middle East, that are done on the behest of Israel, whether it's in Syria and Iraq, in Afghanistan, or in Yemen now. This letter I kind of dug up because I think it's relevant to our questions here. You know, our founding fathers, because I'm an American citizen also, our founding fathers like Jefferson were actually very insightful about some things that could happen and would happen. And I think this letter that's sent by Jefferson to a rabbi who invited him to basically cut the ribbon on opening the synagogue, it said it all. It says basically, you know, nice that you told me about all the suffering of Jews around the world, etc. But, you know, it confirms in my mind what actually happens is that any sect, if you put it in charge, you know, it will cause suffering for other people. So we were trying here, and he's admitting that they are not succeeding at it. It takes some time. We're trying to remedy this via laws. And I think that's very, very prophetic, again, of Thomas Jefferson. The other thing we have to think about is that politics and economy are interconnected. And this demonstrations in Jordan, as I showed you earlier, illustrate this, that you cannot isolate economy from politics. This is the supposed average GDP per capita in different Arab states, oil-rich states like in the Gulf region. You can see the average per capita is what is given. For example, Qatar is the highest, and then you have United Arab Emirates followed by the others. Like Kuwait, etc. But this is not the real picture. The real picture is, of course, the disparity between this. When we say the average is, for example, 68,000, doesn't mean that, you know, many people make 68,000. Actually, they either make millions and billions or they make zero. Saudi Arabia actually is one of the poorest number of poor people in Saudi Arabia. It is huge. People are literally walking around in the desert like they did 1,500 years ago. They are desperately poor. And, of course, you have people like, what's his name, the guy? That's in charge, you know, has billions and billions of dollars. And these guys, you know, they take the money of these countries and they give them as they wish. For example, this guy, he sat down with Trump. Well, Trump very insultingly, you know, sitting with him and saying, look what this guy gave us, for nothing. You know, there's billions here, billions there, billions there. He had even a chart in front of him. I mean, it's almost like a doctored picture, but it's an actual picture. It's unbelievable. And they have the chutzpah, if I may use that word, to say that they are Arabs, you know, when they are actually killing people in Yemen, for example, starving people, children in Yemen. This to me is amazing, you know, that we allow such spectacle to go on in our part of the world. Now I want to switch a little bit again. You know, you'd have to excuse me for this presentation because I want to kind of give what you call all the symptoms of the problems of humanity, and then towards the end I want, with your help, to try and arrive at something rather coherent or logical. We face unprecedented dangers today. And when I mentioned that before, colonialism or even genocide, as happened in Congo, were localized phenomena, today there's no localized phenomena. Because, for example, pushing the issue of Iran or North Korea and all of this stuff could end up in nuclear war, by the way, which is, you know, the people, the scientists who are putting that clock, if you remember, they're saying, like, we are 2 minutes to midnight. We as a species could begun, or at least as organized human societies, we may go back to being, foragers and hunters, foragers, whatever. And we may be having forced to eat roaches because they will survive and proliferate after nuclear war. So a nuclear war could devastate the human society. But also the environmental issue, which I don't have time to go into, but it's my passion as a biologist to speak about climate change and what's happening and all of this stuff. These two dangers, global climate change and global nuclear war, could end Homo sapiens as an organized, quote-unquote, civilization, although I may debate with you whether we are civilized or not yet. But anyways, I put the slide about biodiversity. So now we need to push that button called to action, because if we don't do that, if we don't think what is our role and how are we going to affect this transformation to go back to a level of sanity so that we don't have people like Netanyahu and Abu Mazen and Trump heading our affairs, we are in trouble, not just as local communities here in America or in Palestine or in Israel or whatever, but as a species we have problem. And I think we have to really start to appreciate the level of the danger that we face. I put this picture because it illustrates human diversity. And human diversity is strength for us. The fact that we have people who work for human justice around the world, and even at the National Geographic, by the way, headquarters, where I'm attending this Explorer Symposium, I can tell there is a disparity between those in power at the institution and the people who are doing a lot of the work. What do I mean by that? Even when I registered, by the way, for National Geographic Explorer community, I scrolled down to put my country. There's nothing there. Doesn't have Palestine, doesn't have West Bank and Gaza. I looked under O for occupied Palestinian territory. There's nothing. So what am I going to do? You know, and I'm still struggling with them. Hopefully they can change that. But on the other hand, I'm talking to people there, you know, from all corners of the world, Indonesia, Malaysia, Kenya, who are doing amazing work, local work that really makes a difference in the lives of common people. But these are people who don't have the power. So this is the other part of the conundrum which I want us to think about. Is the people who are doing the good work are not the people who are in power. And the people who are in power are the ones who are doing more damage than they are doing good. How do we remedy this? How do we, and I was actually met with Ralph Nader, and Claire Nader is here, and we talked yesterday. And he gave me his book about power, and I was reading in it. And it's a remarkable little book because it was, explaining that there are times in human history when indeed there was effective power. And if you think about it, even in American history, what are the positive things that happened to us here as Americans? And how did we get those things? Right of women to vote, civil rights, ending the war in Vietnam, 40-hour work week, workman safety, highway safety, using even car seat belts, which Ralph Nader was key in doing that. All of these things happened to us because, these little people, if you want, got together and said, there's something, something not quite right, we have to fix it. Now, we are in 4.5 billion years of Earth history, a beautiful planet, by the way, and we humans are in the past 8,000 years, which is nothing in world history. And humans could, as I said, could go and, dinosaurs also went. So Earth, I'm not worried about Earth. Earth will survive us. With us or without us, Earth will go on. But I do care about human species because I'm part of it and we want to do something different, right? So here comes what I consider part of the solution, which is resistance. And I like this figure, even though I don't know where I got it from. It's not mine. It talks about becoming more human in the sense of becoming more connected to our needs and our society and how we connect to this. And we have to also be optimistic because nothing stays the same. Trump will be gone one way or the other. Netanyahu will be gone. All of these things will change. Nothing stays the same. And I take solace from the hopes of people like Arundhati Roy, who said that another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. And things like that, like Martin Luther King, what he said is, people need to act, basically. And Frederick Douglass, for example, said power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. I would like someday, when I meet Abu Mazen, is to give him this quote in Arabic. it doesn't happen by going to them and begging for the morsels of giving us a state, And to end, I like, my wife is Chinese American, so I like Chinese proverbs. To know and not to do is not to know. Better to light a candle than curse the darkness. I hear and I forget. I see and I remember. I do and I understand. And for us Palestinians, doing things on the ground is the best school. So when politicians say, what's to do? I say, go down to the street. Go down, demonstrate with us. Go down, get arrested with us. And yesterday I spoke at Plymouth Church, and the Reverend Hagler was actually just arrested in the Poor People's March. So I want to kind of leave you with a question, and for us to discuss it together, I want to hear your opinion about how we collectively can move together to a better world. Because ultimately we don't have much of a choice. We either, as I said, we either as a species we fail or as a species we succeed. There's no winners and losers in the conflicts that are happening today. I'm sorry, Saudi Arabia is not going to win the war on Yemen or the Yemeni resistance going to win over Saudi hegemony. Wars are lose-lose. And lose-lose scenarios that are getting more and more devastating because wars 200 years ago, 80, 90, 95% of the victims of the ones who lose their lives were the soldiers fighting it. Today, less than 1% of those who are fighting the war are soldiers. Who are victims of wars are the soldiers. The remainder are civilians. That's who pays the price. So we cannot, and even soldiers, by the way, they pay a much heavier price also now because of the way the wars are fought and because of the way they see the wars are being fought. So the biggest killer of American soldiers now, do you know what? Suicide. 22 a day are committing suicide. So, you know, it's amazing. So anyway, I'll stop here, and I want to thank you for your attention, and I hope you sign the email list that we passed around, and I'm happy to talk about any subject you want because I'm not, you know.
Thank you. Dr. Mazin, thank you so much for a great presentation. Thank you.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have this morning. You've been listening to Professor Mazin Kuncia of Bethlehem University, speaking from Washington, D.C.
Well, I think up until the year 2000, what we had is an economy which was expanding, and it was purposely done that way, where we were all working to build up a large nest egg, which they knew long in advance they were going to harvest and take away from us. And that's basically what's happened since the year 2000. Now the economy's going down because they're slowly taking the cream off of the top. And, you know, in 2008, there was a large, you know, harvesting right there in one chunk. And probably we're going to see something like that again.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Mirandi Bridge in Genoa. Where's the CCTV? Did it really collapse or was it blown up? Are we even allowed to ask? So you think you couldn't be hoodwinked by the entire media? Working in concert to ignore vital facts we all need to know? Think again. The economic wars, not just between Trump and Erdogan and President Xi. What about the war raging between Brussels and Rome? The London corporate media hardly mention it. So, who chooses Italian governments? The Italian voters or Goldman Sachs and Mario Draghi at the European Central Bank? Also, the death of an Israeli terrorist who fought the British Mandate in the 1940s. He turned a peace activist and died believing the 1990s Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat was poisoned by the Israeli state with polonium. The Jewish terrorist who sided with the Palestinians. And as the FBI and others move maybe to impeach US President Donald Trump, he explains to Fox News why he thinks his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, has been making scurrilous accusations about him. And we, in our series Getting to Know the Israeli Cabinet, this week the foreign minister, who is he or she? And what have they been saying this week? Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots. places the mass media turn a blind eye to. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, the inside story of Bristol Friends of the Earth's Clean Air campaign about hundreds of premature deaths in the city which caused such consternation in Bristol City Hall. They ordered the city's only non-commercial billboard with that information on it removed. And Scotland's Fresh Start Foundation for survivors of child sex abuse the authorities won't listen to. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday. Or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Now, if you like. So first of all, Martin, we're going to have a look at Trump, I think, to start with. I mean, we're going to have a look, I suppose. This is looking really, I suppose, at geopolitics generally, which is who really runs things and to what extent the deep state is running things. And these politicians are just there sort of, for the public and the media to talk about, almost like a kind of puppet show.
Well, that's pretty accurate. What in particular are we discussing in relation to the Donald?
Well, this is about whether, what might be going on with all these accusations against Trump. Is the idea to put political pressure on him one way or another?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Democrats are hoping to take the House and the Senate in November, and then they're hoping to use this fact that these women were paid off by Trump to impeach him. But I think that's delusionary on their part. It's clutching at straws. Trump's support doesn't care if he paid these women off. They're not bothered. And you could argue that they ought to be, but they aren't.
So, I mean, it doesn't matter. You can break the law with impunity, can he?
Well, yes. I mean, it's all politics. I mean, ultimately, if Trump loses the political support of sufficient political support, he'll be impeached. But those who are impeaching him, of course, even if he was impeached, Mike Pence takes over, who's an even more paleoconservative than Trump. So it doesn't change anything. And in actual fact, Trump's tried to do stuff which the deep state doesn't like rapprochement with Russia, he's basically been outmaneuvered anyway. I mean, the more sanctions on Russia have just been agreed, whatever Trump thinks. So, I mean, Trump basically is not really in charge. Putin is in charge in Russia, so there's an asymmetry there. In the West, the people you see aren't the ones in charge, and that's not the case in Russia.
Anyway, the Fox News presenter Ainsley Earhart interviewed Donald Trump this week. Here's a little clip from that as he explains what he thinks really going on with Michael Cohen, his lawyer.
Michael Cohen had, I guess, a taxi business, and somebody reported him for some things in his taxi business, and that's how this started. And they put the two counts of campaign violations in there, but a lot of lawyers on television, and also lawyers at IFC, that they're not even crimes.
If you're saying the payments, if they're not illegal, then why would he use that information for a
because
plea deal?
Because he makes a better deal when he uses me, like everybody else. And one of the reasons I respect Paul Manafort so much is he went through that trial. You know, they make up stories. People make up stories. This whole thing about flipping, they call it. I know all about flipping. For 30, 40 years, I've been watching Flippers. Everything's wonderful, and then they get 10 years in jail, and they flip on whoever the next highest one is, or as high as you can go. It almost ought to be outlawed. It's not fair, because if somebody's going to spend 5 years like Michael Cohen, or 10 years, or 15 years in jail because of a taxicab industry, because he defrauded some bank, the last two were the tiny ones. You know, campaign violations are considered not a big deal, mm-hmm. frankly. But if somebody defrauded a bank and he's going to get 10 years in jail or 20 years in jail, but if you can say something bad about Donald Trump and you'll go down to 2 years or 3 years, which is the deal he made, in all fairness to him, most people are going to do that. And I've seen it many times. I've had many friends involved in this stuff. It's called flipping, and it almost ought to be illegal. You get 10 years in jail, but if you say bad things about somebody, in other words, make up stories if you don't know, make up stories, they just make up lies. Alan Dershowitz said, compose, right? They make up lies. I've seen it many times. They make up things, and now they go from 10 years to they're a national hero. They have a statue erected in their honor. It's not a fair thing, but that's why he did it. He made a very good deal. I mean, for what he did.
So is Donald Trump there at least attempting, Martin, to explain why he thinks that Michael Cohen has been spilling the beans about his private affairs? Actually, this is really all about a case where Donald Trump's lawyer was involved in some kind of fraud to do with the New York taxis, I believe, or Washington taxis.
Well, I mean, who can get to the bottom of all of this and who can follow it all? The politics of it are fairly clear. The Trump is being attacked by his political enemies within the establishment in the US, and they're using any mechanism they can to try and catch him out. And, of course, he was bankrupt several times and rescued by the mafia and other unsavoury people, so he's got plenty of skeletons in the cupboard. But the fact of the matter is that it's, the people trying to get him are equally criminal. So we're talking about a criminalised ruling class in the US, as Donald Trump, just I've seen these flippers all the time. He's been involved in dirty deals all his life, but then he's not the only one. They all are.
So it's basically tax fraud to do with these taxi companies in New York, actually. But what's happened is there's been a plea bargain. So this is a way, I suppose, that they can say, well, if you say this and say this, then you're going to get a lesser sentence. Now,
that's what Trump is suggesting.
Yeah, I mean, it looks pretty clear that he's correct about that, that's why Michael Cohen has made these statements about Trump, because he doesn't want to spend so much time in jail.
Well, that may be so, and I think the fact is that Trump, that the people who are attacking Trump are often attacking him for the wrong reasons, and the things that they're attacking him for are either trivial or, if Trump paid off these women not to spill the beans about his love life, well, that's pretty reprehensible in one way, but in another way, it's pretty standard for US politics. And it's not, and anybody who voted for Trump isn't going to change their mind about him on that basis. And we'll have to see which way this plays out. If the Democrats win the Senate and the Congress, but the Congress are more likely to win, then you may see impeachment about anything coming forward against Trump. But, I mean, as I said earlier, even if Trump was impeached, you just get Mike Pence, which is more of the same anyway. And even if you got a Democrat elected, unless it was somebody really radical like Tulsi Gabbard, you're not going to get any change anyway. I mean, the system in the US is run by billionaires, for billionaires, and the Pentagon, and everything else is window dressing.
Well, moving to look at Israel now, and as I said, we'd have a look at the Israeli foreign minister. Martin, do you know who the Israeli foreign minister is?
Is it not Avigdor Lieberman? It used to be.
Lieberman is the defence minister. Who is the foreign minister?
This
is a bit cruel.
Well, I don't know, is the simple answer.
It's Benjamin Netanyahu.
Oh, he's his own foreign minister.
He's also foreign minister. So there you go. And it saves any disagreements between him and a foreign minister, doesn't it?
Yes.
So I thought we'd have a listen now to hear. And it's actually just back a few weeks, but when US John Bolton turned up in Jerusalem. So let's have a little listen to that now. This is Benjamin Netanyahu really setting out his stall, I suppose, and not only as Prime Minister, but also as Foreign Minister.
I believe that the President's decision to leave the disastrous Iran's deal was nothing less than a hinge of history. And Israel applauds the Trump administration's determination to reimpose tough sanctions on Iran and those doing business with Iran. I know that that view is shared by all our Arab neighbors, or practically everyone in this region, and I frankly believe that all countries who care about peace and security in the Middle East should follow America's lead and ratchet up the pressure on Iran. Because the greater the pressure on Iran, the greater the chance that the regime will roll back its aggression, and everybody should join this effort. In standing up to the regime, we stand with the people of Iran. The President has made it clear, Secretary Pompeo has made that clear, you have made it clear, and I have made it clear too in numerous appeals, direct appeals to the people of Iran. And it's important that the people of Iran understand that our fight is not with them. Our fight is with the regime that brutally represses them, that arrests women for uncovering their hair, that hangs gays in the public squares, that defies the aspirations for freedom of millions and millions of Iranians. Ambassador Bolton, Israel is also grateful for the Trump administration's unequivocal support for Israel in international forums and on international issues. We hear it every day in the podiums, in the White House, in the State Department, at the United Nations. This is deeply, deeply appreciated and deeply valued. We appreciate as well the continuing American commitment to maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge, which enables us to defend ourselves by ourselves against any threat. Welcome to Jerusalem.
Now, just Mr. Prime Minister, thank you very much for that warm welcome. It's a privilege.
This is John Bolton, National Security Advisor of the U.S.
in Jerusalem, Israel's capital. And I look.
Did you say that again?
Israel's capital. And I look forward to visiting the American embassy in Jerusalem that President Trump ordered some time back. I think your analysis of the issues that we have to face is right on spot target. It's a question of the highest importance for the United States that Iran never get a deliverable nuclear weapons capability. It's why President Trump withdrew from the wretched Iran nuclear deal. It's why he is reimposing economic sanctions. It's why we've worked with our friends in Europe to convince them of the need to take stronger steps against the Iranian nuclear weapons and ballistic missile program. It's why we continue to worry about Iran's role as the central banker of international terrorism. It's why we worry about Iran's belligerent military activity in Iraq, in Syria, with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and in Yemen. All of these threats in the region are also global threats because of the risk of international terrorism and especially terrorist possible use of weapons of mass destruction.
Thank you. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Well, that was a little love-in between Bolton and Netanyahu, wasn't it? A match made in heaven from their own point of view and a match made in hell from everybody else's point of view.
Talking about the wretched nuclear deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, and also Netanyahu going about the lack of freedom in Iran, unlike the lack of freedom in Saudi Arabia, of course, where everybody gets votes all the time and the women can drive and nobody's forced to cover their heads. It's just drivel, frankly.
It's really just about
dangerous drivel.
It's about nuclear weapons. Why should it be a good thing for the Iranians to get nuclear weapons?
Well, it's not about. They want a regime change in Iran. There's no evidence that the Iranians have nuclear weapons, and the International Atomic Energy Agency have said that they've been completely in compliance with everything that they were asked to do. And that's the position of all other countries, apart from two, the United States, Israel, and I think Guatemala and some other smaller small fry that have been swept up in it. Everybody else is perfectly happy with the fact that they've not got nuclear weapons. And this isn't about nuclear weapons. The Israelis want a war with Iran. That's what they want. And they want the British to fight it as well. Our ships are out there. And if the war starts, we're going to be in it. Do we want a war with Iran to help the Israelis? I think people listening to this show need to make their minds up, because if we don't, we better tell them.
So this week, Israel's Foreign Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Prime Minister, wrapped into one, was in Lithuania. And he's actually from, I believe, that part of the world. His family are, anyway.
Yeah, his name isn't Netanyahu. He's originally born in Poland, I believe, or what is now Belarusia.
Apparently his grandparents are from Lithuania.
Well, that may be so.
But anyway, so let's have a listen to what he had to say over in the... why might Netanyahu want to visit the Baltic countries, Martin?
Because it's all part of the, the ramping up of the enemy. This is ramping up the enemy being Russia. At the same time, of course, he went to Moscow for the May Day, the commemoration of winning World War II parade. So he's popping to Moscow all the time, and Putin allows him to come because Putin basically wants to talk to him, even though he's a gangster. And of course, he's in Lithuania.
Well, Putin isn't.
Well, that's right, because Putin's a gangster. He wants to talk to the other gangsters. He talks to everybody, unlike the British, who can't be bothered to pick up the phone. And that's called diplomacy, Tony.
Anyway, so let's have a listen to see what Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Foreign Minister and Prime Minister, had to say in Vilnius this week.
I'm deeply honored to be the first Israeli Prime Minister to visit Lithuania. I want to congratulate you on recently celebrating 100 years of Lithuania's independence. Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. We, too, are proud of our history, our long history, our robust and pluralistic democracy, which guarantees the rights of all our citizens, We're proud of our language, an ancient language, Hebrew, revived after thousands of years, our traditions, and our historic capital, Jerusalem, to which I invite you and your colleagues. We can do better together. And I want to stress that everything, every single endeavor of human activity is becoming technology. Israel is a world leader in industries of the future, from cybersecurity to automotive driving, autonomous driving, to precision agriculture, digital health, every manner of IT, and so many other fields. Equally, I appreciate the fact that you have taken a very sober position on the question of the Iran deal. It was a terrible deal. And today, we learned that three major carriers, BA, KLM, and Air France, have discontinued their activity in Iran. That's good. More should follow, more will follow, because Iran should not be rewarded for its aggression in the region, for its attempts to spread terrorism far and wide, in the Middle East, into Europe, as they did the other week, and to many other places in the world. Vilnius was known as Jerusalem of Lita, Jerusalem of Lithuania. But as you know, there was also a dark chapter. The Jews of Lithuania were almost entirely wiped out in the Holocaust by the Nazis and their collaborators. And Mr. Prime Minister, you have taken great steps to commemorate the victims of the Holocaust, to speak openly about this horrible crime that must never be repeated. And I want to thank you for your commitment to fighting anti-Semitism wherever it rears its ugly head.
Well, that's quite interesting because, of course, during the German occupation, the right wing in Lithuania collaborated with the Holocaust. So that's a rather pointed remark at the end by Netanyahu. And, of course, the whole thing about Israel being a state as old as Lithuania, well, that's just not true. I mean, the state of Lithuania has been there a long time, although it was absorbed into the Soviet Union. It used to be Poland-Lithuania, and there used to be a massive country.
You're talking about 100 years or 50 years of independence.
Yes,
actually, it wasn't really independent from the Soviet Union.
Well, it was absorbed into the Soviet Union from World War II until the 1990s. So there was a period of a non-independence. But they got independence as a result of the Russian Revolution, because they were part of the Russian Empire before that.
What about British Airways, KLM and Air France stopping flights to Iran? He's celebrating.
Well, that's what's happening. Is that the plan is that come November, all Iranian oil will be embargoed and they won't be able to export any oil at all. But what the Iranians are saying, well, in that case, everybody else's oil is going to be embargoed. And I read an interesting thing this week, which I didn't know, that the only navigable bits of the Straits of Hormuz are entirely within Iranian territorial waters. So if they choose to close the Straits of Hormuz, they'll be absolutely within their rights to do so.
Looks like another plate spinning ready to fall, doesn't it?
Well, the danger is that there's going to be a miscalculation. It will end up in war. And I say to the Israelis, if you go to war with Iran, even with the support of the Israelis, of the Americans, you ain't necessarily going to win.
It's not necessarily a miscalculation. A lot of the time, if we look at history, these wars have been deliberately kicked off.
Well, I think we need to concentrate our minds on the possibility of war here. The thing that's preventing war is the calmness of the Russians, for example. There's a massive military exercise going on in the Baltics at the moment, the biggest one ever. And the Russians
by
are just
NATO,
yes, and the Russians are just watching with their arms folded. It's like as if they were having a massive military exercise in the Channel, and we've just got to watch it. And the same with the Iranians. They're being told that they're going to have to do this, that, and the other. Otherwise, because they're calm, they're not going to overreact.
Anyway,
but if there's any miscalculation, this will end in war, in Russia and in Iran.
Israeli former terrorist and turned peace activist Yuri Avni died this week. Who was he?
Well, he wasn't born Yuri Avni. I was reading about him. He was actually born Helmut something or other. I can't remember a German name. He was born in Germany before the war, and his family emigrated to Israel to avoid Hitler. And he was a terrorist in the underground fighting the British as a teenager. And then he became notoriously pro-Palestinian. Yep. Because he basically said, well, we took the land by force, and if I was a young Palestinian, I would feel exactly as they feel, and I understand why they feel as they do.
Anyway, let's have
very, very humane guy.
Let's have a listen to him now.
Arafat put an end to violence whenever he saw a path to peace by peaceful means. After the Oslo Agreement, until the assassination of Mr. Rabin, there was hardly any violence at all. Before the attack, our attack on Lebanon, for 11 months after the ceasefire brokered by the American diplomat Habib, for 11 months, not one single bullet was shot at the northern front. Arafat was very strongly committed to achieving peace with Israel on his terms. This must be stressed.
I just wonder if, on a personal level, you ever talked to him about terrorism, about the need to put an end to the terrorism.
When you say terrorism, you mean Palestinian resistance, armed resistance.
You don't consider it terrorism?
I consider it terrorism like the terrorism of the Algerian freedom fighters, of the Kenyan freedom fighters, the South African freedom fighters, terrorism of Mandela, of Mbella, of Kenyatta, and two dozen other liberation fighters in the last 50 years. All liberation fights used this kind of violence, sometimes much more cruel violence than the Palestinians ever used.
That's the voice of Uri Avni, who died this week. Martin, you also believed that Arafat was poisoned with polonium.
Quite likely. And of course, because he was himself a terrorist, inverted commas, Uri Avnery was very much aware of, you can't tell people who are on the receiving end of occupation and violence that they've got to be non-violent.
Anyway.
There's no reason why they should, is there?
Certainly not. Let's have a listen now to Manfred Petrisch. He's originally Swiss-German, born in Argentina, worked in the financial services industry. And I had a fascinating chat, I thought anyway, with him about this Genoa-Morandi bridge collapse. But he started off by talking about the entire financial system and why actually Goldman Sachs is at war with Rome right now.
My name is Manfred Petrisch, and I run a blog since 9/11, so it's more than 17 years now. I mainly write for the German-speaking public, but also, like this year, I'm interviewed also for the English speakers.
Now, what makes you qualified to speak? What's your background?
I'm a truth seeker, and therefore I was very frustrated. The media is telling us, and I discovered, like many people, that the media isn't telling the truth about all the things that are happening, starting with 9/11. And then when you start researching all the things also in history, you find out that a lot of things are lies, that wars are started with lies, etc. And I try to give the other side of the picture, you know. I was working for 40 years in the financial services industry. I also had a customer in the World Trade Center in the North Tower on the 26th floor, Eurobrokers. And my customer, of course, I was very worried when 9/11 happened, if they all survived or not. And well, they did, because after about 6 weeks, I made contact with them and they told me what they actually experienced. And they experienced things that are not in the official statement. They experienced an explosion before the plane hit the building. So they experienced an explosion coming out of the basement before the first plane hit their tower. And that, of course, contradicts completely the official narrative.
Okay, you've worked in the financial services industry. Many would point to that, particularly in Switzerland, as one of the biggest problems on the planet. Did you see dishonesty or honesty?
Well, I can say now that I'm retired that, of course, the finance industry is governmentally legalized theft and corruption. It's legalized by the government so that the people are robbed. What a lot of people don't understand is how actually money is created. They think that the central banks create money, but it is not. Money is created by the people taking up a credit. The procedure of getting a credit is actually the procedure of money creation. That's why our system, our financial system, is a debt-based system. by being in debt, be it a private person or a company or a whole country, is the way to control the debtor. That's how you control them. And if they can't pay, you take over all the things that they gave you as a security. That's why for a bank, the best thing that can happen is if you default. That's the best thing that can happen. That's the biggest business then.
That's interesting, isn't it, that for a long time, banks were seen to be a very important part of a country's national infrastructure. Now it's international.
The big banks are just like the big corporations. They float over the countries. They are above countries. And they don't care about national laws or any restrictions. They are just above the law, and they control the politicians. And they also make the laws through their lobby groups, and the whole system, especially in the EU, but also in America, they only take care of the big, big corporations. They don't care about it, the little people. You see, the only country that actually profited from the euro is Germany. All other countries were... You know, they made loss. And the reason is, by introducing the euro as a common currency, the Deutschmark, the strong Deutschmark, that increased the value of all the other, for the currency for all the other countries, which means that their export didn't work anymore. You see, before the euro, all the countries had their own currencies, and they were they could control their own currencies, and they could and they were actually quite cheap in relation to the Deutschmark and the dollar. Therefore, their exports were blooming, and everybody went to Italy or Spain or Portugal or Greece for cheap holiday or for buying cheap products. That all changed when the euro was introduced, and Italy, Greece, Spain, Portugal, France, etc., they all became too expensive in as before, and therefore their export kind of collapsed. The only country that profited from the euro is Germany, because things became cheaper as under the Deutschmark. You see, Draghi, the head of the ECB, has to pump 40 billion euros every month into the system. I mean, it's like a coma patient in a hospital that is only alive because he's connected to all the life supporting system. And if you would disconnect the life supporting system, he would die. That means if the ECB decides to stop pumping in the money every month, then the euro will immediately collapse.
But the Germans said, didn't they, that this was quantitative easing, this pumping this money into the system was not allowed.
Yes, but they are doing it. The ECB is doing it since years now. You know, Draghi said it costs what it wants. We will pay for everything. You know, they're pumping money like crazy. Just like the Fed, by the way, pumping up the dollar. Germany is profiting from this whole thing. You see, the euro and the EU was created as an economic union and not a democratic union to the welfare of the EU people. It is only to the welfare of the big corporations who sell their products across all the countries and borders.
What about Italy? Because we've had elections at the beginning of this year, 2018, and then there was no government. And finally, I think it was around about June, there was a coalition set up between La Liga, which is a right wing, and Five Star, which is a left wing, but both Eurosceptic parties. So we've got an interesting situation in Italy, a Eurosceptic government, but they haven't been allowed to choose their own chief ministers, have they? So what's happening in Italy?
Well, there again, the ECB intervened into the forming of the government. That means the designated finance minister that the new government wanted to put in mentioned that he wants the ECB to cancel 250 billion euros in debt. The ECB immediately intervened and contacted the president of Italy and said, you're not going to let them take over. You have to do new elections in autumn, and meantime you have to put in a technocrat. to run the government. And only when the Lega and the Five Star Movement backed down from this demand of $250 billion canceling of the debt, then they were allowed to form a government. That's why it took so long between the election in March and then the forming of the government in June. So Italy is totally under the control of the ECB. And it's not the first time, because remember Berlusconi. There was a putsch against Berlusconi, and he had to step down because the ECB intervened by increasing the interest rate for the Italian government bonds. And they forced him to step down. So the ECB is constantly intervening in all the governments. And they are saying who is going to be in the government or not. The financial system says that, and not the democratic election.
No, I know you've been looking at what's happened in Genoa, this horrific Morandi Bridge collapse, and questioning as to whether that might be deliberate. Is there any evidence that the bridge did not fall by accident?
Yes, there are a lot of evidence, and I can all list them. First of all, when I saw that only video done by this guy, Daniele Di Giorgio, he is the only one who actually filmed the collapse. I mean, you can see the partial collapse. I noticed at the beginning of his video that there were two bright lights lighting up. I said, oh, that's funny, that first there is this bright light going up twice, and then the bridge collapses, or the column collapses, because the bridge was already down. I mean, the road track was already fallen. And I said, gee, that looks very much like a controlled demolition. And then I was thinking, a structural engineer from Germany, and he said to me exactly what I was thinking, and he's an expert in bridge building. He told me, according to that video, that was never just collapsed by gravity. The force of gravity cannot destroy a bridge in that way as it was destructed. So these light flashes that you see at the beginning of the Di Giorgio video, it doesn't look right. And then we continue. Then the media said, well, it was because of lack of maintenance and corruption, blah, blah, blah. But this is also not true, because Professor Antonio Brentzisic, who is the professor for building and construction at the University of Genoa, said that this bridge, I quote him, the bridge was monitored by a pool of experts. There was never a lack of money. The bridge was continuously maintained. So this story in all the media that the bridge collapsed because lack of maintenance is not true. It was in a good state. And the company, the Autostrada d'Italia, in charge of the bridge, said that this bridge would have lasted 100 years. And therefore, this whole collapse thing because of lack of maintenance and deterioration of the material is just not true.
But they have actually shown, haven't they, photographs, pictures up close underneath the bridge where you can see it's like a whole patchwork of repairs. It does look as if it's a bit of a cowboy job.
Yeah, but every bridge. I mean, how long have the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge been standing? And there you can go and see rust. They're continuously getting rid of the rust and painting it. The same is with all the bridges across the Hudson River in New York, etc., etc. There is a constant maintenance because you have to do things. So, of course, if you are actually looking for it, you will always find something. And now they are just pushing this narrative. Then, of course, there are all the witnesses who have come forward now and said what they experienced. Like Davide Capello, he was sitting in his car driving across the bridge when he heard a huge bang, and then the bridge dropped in front of him. And then he himself fell down with his car 40 meters, and he was saved by his airbags, which opened up when he hit the ground. So that means there was first a loud explosion and then the bridge collapsed. Right? So that's one witness. But there are more. There is this guy, Piero Giorgio. He said, I was sitting with my mother in my car underneath the bridge as the surrounding lit up bright and there was a big bang. So that also confirms that first there was a big light flash and then the noise of what could be an explosion. And then he said, then a strange thing happened. My car started bouncing up and down and I thought it was an earthquake. Well, that all this description describes an explosion. And there are more witnesses who are saying things like that. So that, how can you believe that such a complete destruction and crushing of all this concrete and steel and everything can only be caused by gravity? That's ridiculous.
Underneath the bridge where it was railway lines. Couldn't the flashes just have been the bridge falling on the electrical pylons on the railway?
No, and I'll tell you why. You see, a short circuit of these electrical overhead wires of the railway can only cause a spark if they touch the ground. So you have to have grounding. But the bridge was on top of it. The bridge fell onto the cable and pushed it to the ground. So that means you would never see a flash because the bridge would be on top of the cable and suffocating any short circuit light flashes.
How easy is it to blow up a bridge?
It's very easy because in many countries in Europe, like in Switzerland, Germany, and in other countries, there is a special chambers built into all the bridges which are filled with explosives. You see, all the bridges are, from design point of view, made in a way that you can destroy them. Because if there is a war, you blow up the bridge to stop the enemy from using them.
Now, hang on, because are you saying that the explosives are in there all the time or that there is a special place you can place the explosives?
Well, both. For instance, in Switzerland, the bridges had the explosives in this special chamber, and they were only taken out about 10 years ago. But anyway, there are chambers in all the bridges by design to be filled by explosives so that when this is ignited, the bridge collapses. That's done by design because of if there is a war, you can destroy the bridge so that the enemy can't use them.
What about the CCTV? Because you would expect that there would be quite a lot of CCTV footage showing the bridge falling.
Exactly, but they're not showing them. That's exactly the point. They've only been released three videos up to now from these CCTV cameras, although the whole bridge and the whole access roads to the bridge, they are full of cameras, but they've only shown us three videos which don't tell us anything. They don't show the actual collapse. And that is also very suspect. Because why aren't they showing us all the videos so that we can see, oh yeah, that's how the bridge collapsed. No, they're not showing them. They're hiding them. You know what that reminds me of? That reminds me of the Pentagon at 9/11 because there were 85 cameras all around the Pentagon. And they haven't shown us one single CCTV footage of this plane hitting the Pentagon. We have never seen this CCTV footage from these 85 cameras. So also those are hidden because then we would know the truth. And the same thing looks like it's also happening with this bridge.
Now, there's a massive tower which did collapse. Many people would say, Manfred, well, look, if the roadway collapsed by fatigue or accidentally, even though, of course, it wasn't all that heavily loaded, I mean, apparently there are traffic jams on that bridge sometimes which make it much more heavily loaded, but if it did collapse, the roadway would then possibly bring that enormous tower down because it would be only pulling on one side, a whole massive roadway pulling one side of the tower when the other side is gone is likely to bring it down.
Well, that's also a very, a naive argument because on the contrary, the column was so massive. It had such a massive foot, a very broad foot to stand by itself. And if the roadway would collapse, there would be less stress on the column. Less stress, because the road is gone. How can it then collapse? And you see it also in the DiGiorgio video, that the column was still standing when the road collapsed, and then the light flashes came on, and then the column collapsed. So this is how the sequence was. The sequence was, first the road fell down, the column was still standing, then there were two of these light flashes, which could be the explosion, and then the column collapsed. That's how the sequence was.
Well, it wasn't the only bomb to take place in Italy, because there was also an attack on the other party that the Five Star Party are involved in. And Grillo and the Five Star Party are based in Genoa, so it's right on their home territory. But right across the other side of Italy, in Treviso, near Venice, is where the La Liga had a bomb outside their offices too.
Actually, two. You're right. There were two. One exploded and the other one was diffused. So in my opinion, if you ask me what is actually happening and why is it happening, this is an attack by what you could call the deep state against this new anti-EU government, to kind of tell them, well, you know, if you don't follow the rules, you will have terror in your country. And we will do things like that. Because remember the Bologna attack, right? The Bologna attack, which happened on the 2nd of August in 1980, where the railway station in Bologna was blown up, 80 people died and 200 were injured. And this was blamed on the Red Brigade. And the reason was that at that time, Italy was leaning more to the left. And this was a signal that you're not going to go into the left or communist area. But actually what happened was that after a lot of research and looking into the whole thing, it was found out that the NATO secret army, the so-called stay-behind army, Gladio, was behind this explosion of the Bologna railway station, plus the Italian Secret Service and the Freemason Lodge P2. They were all involved in this explosion. So this is not the first time that there was a kind of a false flag attack against the threat of a left-leaning government. Now we have more a right-leaning government. And they want to teach them a lesson and say, hey, you know, do what we say or you will have terror.
Well, there's also attempts by the new Italian government to set up a parallel currency to the euro, which was reported by Forbes magazine as being the biggest threat to the euro.
Absolutely, because, I mean, if Italy leaves the eurozone, wow. I mean, then you can definitely say the euro is gone. I mean, that's over then. That's why they're doing everything to keep Italy in the euro and in the EU, either by telling the president, who has the authority to actually designate the government, by going through him, or by doing these terror attacks, these false flag terror attacks, right? And that's all threats to the new government to be careful and not realize the promises they did their electors. You know, they promised a lot during the election, that's why they got elected, but they can't do them because of these threats.
So, look, let's just take a step back from this. Who could possibly have carried out such an operation?
Well, demolition experts from the military who are taught how to destroy bridges. I mean, they teach them that. There are whole groups of military personnel who are specialized in blowing up things. Every army has that. And these are recruited by the deep state or by the secret services to fulfill these operations. And then, of course, they control the narrative through the media. You see, every time one of these operations happens, there is also a media script running parallel to what is happening. You see, the media is fed the narrative parallel to what's happening so that the people are then told what to think about this event. I mean, that happened in 9/11. Only in 9/11, the script was faster than the action. Remember that? About World Trade Center 7? Where the BBC and CNN were saying that World Trade Center has collapsed, but it was still standing. That means the media script was running faster than the actual things are happening. That was a big mistake. And that's why all the big news media were saying, well, the World Trade Center has collapsed. But actually, it collapsed a half an hour later. That would be like a TV station saying, well, Bank X has been robbed. But it wasn't robbed. It was robbed and half an hour later. So how did the news people knew that it was going to be robbed? That's one of the big questions that nobody has gone after.
Most people will think, well, nobody would do such a thing, Manfred. Nobody would do such a thing to kill so many people deliberately.
All wars of the last 150 years were created by false flag operations. Going back to the Spanish-American War, where the American ship was blown up by the Americans, the harbor of Havana, to blame it on the Spanish so that they can do a war against Spain. It already started at the end of 1800. And all other wars are like that. The First World War, the Second World War, the war in Vietnam, the Gulf of Tonkin attack by North Vietnamese torpedo boats never happened. It was a complete lie by President Johnson so that he could do the Vietnam War.
No, but there's no war started in Italy.
Yes, it's not a full-scale war, but it is a war against the people. It's a war against the democracy because their wish, what they did in by electing this government, is not being fulfilled. The government can't do what it promised.
Can you tell us where we can find your commentary and your reports on the Morandi Bridge collapse online?
Well, if you Google ASR, you will probably find all my articles I've written. Or if you enter ASR and Genoa, then you will find all my articles about this event with videos and photos and what the witnesses said and what the professor said and all these things.
And finally, is there anything you want to add? Any other big things going on in the world you'd like to talk about?
Well, look what's happening with Turkey. I mean, that's a huge blackmail and a financial crisis that Trump has created because of this fairy tale that it's about this pastor that has been arrested or is under house arrest in Turkey. Well, that's a lot of isn't it? This is a huge attack against Turkey, who is a NATO member. I mean, you said before, well, people think that nothing like that would happen. But the governments, they don't care. They kill people without batting an eye. They're not human. They don't think like us. They think about power and all these things. And I mean, also, what I'd like to mention, that this week was the 65th anniversary of the putsch in Tehran against the democratically elected government of Mossadegh. I mean, I studied this very carefully. The reason was because Mossadegh wanted to take over the oil industry. You see, it was run by the British Oil Company. They wanted to nationalize it. You see, in 1908, this British Petroleum Company was created, which was the forerunner of BP. And it was specially created to suck all the oil wealth generated in Iran out of the country and giving the Iranians nothing for it. Nothing. They got 1% of what was generated there. And then Mossadegh came along and said in 1951, 52, we can't keep going on like that because with the oil revenue, we could cover all the budget needs of the country and we could develop the country, etc. And then the British came along and said, well, you're not allowed to do that. But because the British government was totally in debt after the war, they went to the Americans. Because America took over the whole imperial system from the British after the war. And then the CIA and MI6 created the Operation Ajax, which was the putsch of the Mossadegh government. And they financed demonstrations in Tehran, and they corrupted all the military and politicians, etc., etc. And then he was arrested, Mossadegh was arrested, and the Shah was put into place, a puppet of the Americans and of the British. And after that, Iran became a dictatorship run by the U.S. embassy in Tehran. I actually visited this embassy. You can visit it because it's a museum now. And you can look how an embassy, American embassy, actually functions. And it's incredible what they have. They have a whole department which can create false documents and passports and everything. They have a glass room which is made out of glass. Can you imagine that? So that you can't listen onto it. They had all these communication equipment. So what it means is that the American embassy in Tehran was the actual government of Iran. And that's, by the way, why the students ran onto the territory of the American embassy and took hostage of all the people who were working there, because they knew that it was actually the government of Iran.
Well, fascinating and very topical too, 65th anniversary of the overthrow of Mossadegh as well. But Martin, the main thing is this Mirandi Bridge. Also, there's another I came across. Luciano Goccia was in his lorry directly under the bridge. A pressure wave threw the truck driver out of his vehicle, not the falling debris. He was opening the door to get out, then he heard an explosion. When he turned around, he was thrown through the air.
Well, in Italy, as has been pointed out, there's a long history of false flag terrorism. Operation Gladio was based in Italy. Imposimato was the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book about all of this that came out in 2012, and he was the investigating magistrate. It's beyond dispute that false flag terrorism is, Italy has had lots of experience of it.
Well, anyway,
and it's quite possible this bridge has been blown up.
I shall put a link up to Manfred Petrisch. He's Alles Schall und Rausch, which means all smoke and mirrors. It's in German, but I'm sure you can find some way of getting it translated, and it's got lots of links, and I'll put plenty of links up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Fascinating insight, I think, into what we're not being told by the mainstream press. I would like to see at least some interrogation of these various facts. And I know right now in Italy there's all sorts of pressure being put on by the families of people who died to get that CCTV released. Let's see how they get on. So, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8 now. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM bank holiday weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters, Draghi particularly, get you down.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics on today's show.
And with Michael Cohen, he has been at the nexus of the relationship between the Russian mafia and Donald Trump for quite some time. If you go back many, many years, he and his family owned a restaurant social club called El Carib, which has been the center of operations in Brooklyn for the Russian mafia. So that goes back a long time. So you see this from the very beginning, and I go back more than 35 years to 1984, when for the first time you see Donald Trump meeting with someone close to the Russian mafia. He comes in with $6 million in cash, buys five condos, and there you have it. He has laundered money because Donald Trump asks no questions. Michael Cohen has to know some of what's been going on around this. He's been, you know, Cohen's lawyer. He's been Trump's lawyer for more than 10 years.
A conversation on the backstory of Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort. Our guest is veteran investigative journalist Craig Unger, former editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine and author of the book House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. He joins us next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Trump took to friendly territory today to respond to his former attorney Michael Cohen's guilty plea that he paid off two women at Trump's direction to keep quiet about alleged affairs they'd had with him about a decade ago. Trump told Fox and Friends he believes the economy would go under if Democrats sought to impeach him if they win the House back in November.
I'll tell you what, if I ever got impeached, I think the market would crash. I think everybody would be very poor.
But Trump went on to say he doesn't think he will be impeached. The Fox interviewer asked him directly if Trump knew about the payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal.
Later on, I knew. Later on. But you have to understand, Ainsley, what he did, and they weren't taken out of campaign finance. That's a big thing. That's a much bigger thing. Did they come out of the campaign? They didn't come out of the campaign. They came from me.
However, the claim that Trump only knew about the payments later is contradicted by a recording Cohen made of he and Trump arranging the payments to McDougal and Daniels. Trump also didn't rule out pardoning his former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, who was recently found guilty in federal court on 8 fraud charges.
I have great respect for what he's done in terms of what he's gone through. You know, he worked for Ronald Reagan for years. He worked for Bob Dole. He worked, I guess his firm worked for McCain. He worked for many, many people, many, many years.
Trump also suggested that it should be illegal for people facing prosecution to cooperate with the government in exchange for a reduced sentence. The United States and China went ahead with tariff hikes on billions of dollars of each other's automobiles, factory machinery, and other goods today in an escalation of a battle over Beijing's technology policy that companies worry will chill global economic growth. The increases came as envoys met in Washington for their first high-level talks in 2 months. They gave no sign of progress toward a settlement of U.S. complaints that Beijing steals technology and its industry development plans violate Chinese free trade commitments. The previously announced 25% duties apply to $16 billion of goods from each side, including automobiles and metal scrap from the United States and Chinese-made factory machinery and electronic components. In the first round of tariff hikes, President Trump imposed 25% duties on $34 billion of Chinese imports on July 6th. Beijing responded with similar penalties on the same amount of American goods. Australia's beleaguered prime minister was resisting pressure to quit as opponents from within his own party struggled today to show that he had lost the government's support. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull demanded the names of lawmakers in the Conservative Liberal Party who wanted him to go before he would allow them to choose a new prime minister at a meeting at Parliament House on Friday. The names would provide proof that a majority of his government had abandoned him. Turnbull told reporters he's proud of his government's accomplishments.
The government that I have led has been a very effective one. We've achieved an enormous amount in economic reform and social reform in this parliament, despite the fact that we have had a one-seat majority in the House and a minority in the Senate.
Turnbull could become the fourth prime minister to be dumped by his or her own party before serving a full three-year term in an extraordinary era of political instability that began in 2010. Turnbull's main rival in his government, former cabinet minister Peter Dutton, has told the prime minister that a majority of Liberal Party lawmakers don't support his leadership. But Dutton's supporters today could not find 43 lawmakers prepared to sign their names to a petition demanding a leadership ballot. The British government is warning today that UK residents could face expense and inconvenience if the United Kingdom leaves the European Union next March without a Brexit deal. The government released its first in a series of 25 documents outlining its plan to cope. The Conservative government of Prime Minister Theresa May vowed it would limit the instability that could be triggered by a disorderly Brexit. Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab said he doesn't expect Britain to crash out of the EU, but it's good to be prepared.
But let me be clear about this. It is not what we want, and it's not what we expect, but we must be ready. We have a duty as a responsible government to plan for every eventuality. And to do this, we need to have a sensible, responsible, and realistic conversation about what a no-deal situation really means in practice.
The government's plans include unilaterally accepting some EU rules and giving EU financial services firms continued access to the UK market. A congressional watchdog said the Trump administration needs to step up its management of sign-up seasons for former President Obama's health care law after mixed results last year in the throes of a failed GOP effort to repeal it. The report due out today from the government's accountability office is likely to add to Democrats' election year narrative that the administration actively undermined Obamacare without regard for the consequences to consumers. The nonpartisan government accountability office was more nuanced. On one hand, it found problems with consumer counseling and advertising and recommended some basic fixes, such as setting enrollment targets. But it also credited administration actions that did help people enroll, such as a more reliable healthcare.gov website. The Los Angeles County Department of Public Health issued a public warning about the potentially deadly effects of black tar heroin use. The agency identified three suspected cases of botulism associated with the use of the drug. KPFK's Goonie Larson reports.
According to the Center for Disease Control, botulism is a rare but serious illness caused by a toxin that attacks the body's nerves. The potentially deadly disease is being spread through intravenous drug use, specifically black tar heroin. Dr. Muntu Davis, Los Angeles County's health officer, says the department normally sees 2 to 3 cases of botulism among heroin users per year. Thus, the 6 possible cases in only 2 months is a significant increase and cause for concern. The people at the highest risk of being infected with botulism are needle drug users, especially if they inject contaminated heroin under their skin or into their muscle. Department officials say the contaminated drugs look the same as drugs that do not contain the bacteria and that cooking or heating the drugs will not kill the bacteria which cause botulism. In Los Angeles, I'm Goonie Larson, Pacifica Radio, KPFK.
And I'm Max Pringle. Letters and Politics is next.
Welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to dive into the backstory of Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, Donald Trump, and Russian oligarchs. My guest is Craig Unger. Craig Unger is the editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He is the author of a number of books, including House of Bush, House of Saud. His most recent book is called House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. He also writes for Vanity Fair and The New Republic. He joins me via Skype. Craig Unger, I thank you greatly for taking time this morning to chat with us.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So Lanny Davis yesterday, who is the attorney for Michael Cohen, said on in a number of different television interviews that Michael Cohen may have information that could be of interest to Robert Mueller over whether Trump knew about the hacked emails of the DNC server. That gets sort of back to the beginning of what all this investigation is about, and that and whether or not he would know that he would have information for Mueller about whether or not Trump knew about this even before the hacked emails themselves became public. I certainly don't expect you to tell me what is that information, But you do write a lot about Michael Cohen in your book, House of Trump, House of Putin, as well as Paul Manafort. We're going to dive into both of those. But maybe you could talk to me about what do you know of about what Michael Cohen knows about Donald Trump?
Well, Michael Cohen is a very interesting character, and I think we've seen with Cohen and Manafort, two pieces of the puzzle are starting to reveal themselves. And one is we haven't seen I think most Americans don't know that much about Michael Cohen. A lot of it hasn't come out. But we're also going to see dozens and dozens of other people come out of the woodwork as well. And with Michael Cohen, he has been at the nexus of the relationship between the Russian mafia and Donald Trump for quite some time. If you go back many, many years, he and his family owned a restaurant social club called El Carib, which has been the center of operations in Brooklyn for the Russian mafia. So that goes back a long time. I know at least that Michael Cohen has been close to Felix Sater, who was managing director of a real estate development company that partnered with Russian with Donald Trump in real estate deals. And he also allegedly has had ties to the Russian mafia. So you see this from the very beginning. And I go back more than 35 years to 1984, when for the first time you see Donald Trump meeting with someone close to the Russian mafia. He comes in with $6 million in cash, buys five condos, and there you have it. He has laundered money because Donald Trump asks no questions. And what I learned again and again is that Donald Trump loves doing business with gangsters. They're willing to pay top dollar because essentially they're having their money laundered. And Michael Cohen has to know some of what's been going on around this. He's been, you know, Cohen's lawyer. He's been Trump's lawyer for more than 10 years.
Let me ask you this. Should we be at least skeptical of anything that Michael Cohen says, even though he's now cooperating with the investigation?
Well, there's no question he's lied in the past. And I think when you do this kind of investigation, you enter a world where the only people, the only knowledgeable people are dubious characters who may have criminal records. Felix Sater's a twice convicted felon. Michael Cohen has clearly lied again and again. He'd say he'd take a bullet for Donald Trump, and here he has already turned on him. So, no, I don't think you should take any of these people at their word. But Michael Cohen was the lawyer. He's taped hundreds of these conversations that have to do with these business relationships, and he has documentation. So he's a very interesting source.
Can you tell me more about his business relation? Does he have business relationships with Russian oligarchs?
Well, he has had some very questionable relationships himself, especially in Florida. He had an offshore casino running on a boat for many years that was tied with some questionable Russians who appeared to have ties to the Russian mafia. Through his in-laws, the way he knows Felix Sater, Michael Cohen married a Ukrainian woman, and as did Michael Cohen's brother, Brian Cohen. And through their fathers-in-law, they were connected to various oligarchs tied to the Russian mafia.
Interesting. Let's talk about Paul Manafort as well. Obviously, Michael Cohen seems to be the biggest news this week. But Paul Manafort and the guilty verdict against him is also pretty significant, and maybe even more in some ways closer to the story that you tell in your book, House of Trump, House of Putin. First off, any thoughts on what happened with the ending of this first trial for Manafort this week?
Well, it was very interesting because, it turns out there was at least one hardcore Trumpster on the jury. And nevertheless, Manafort would have been convicted on all 18 counts if that guy had not been on the jury. However, Manafort did prevail. And this is the kind of battle we're going to see again and again. And it's a crucial, crucial victory for Robert Mueller, because Paul Manafort is now in a position where he's going to have to face the rest of it. He has a choice. He can spend the rest of his life in jail, or he can rat out Donald Trump. And that's he's got to make that decision, and we'll see how that unfolds. I don't know the answer.
Well, yesterday, Donald Trump was asked in a Fox News interview as whether he would pardon Paul Manafort. He didn't say yes or no, but he went on to praise extensively Manafort.
Right. I'm not surprised about that. And one of the questions we're going to see again and again is, if Trump pardons people, can they then be retried in state jurisdictions? I don't know the answer to that in this Manafort case. But early on in the Mueller operation, Mueller began sharing data with state attorney general of New York. He's done that in other jurisdictions as well. And I think what's going on is he's trying to spread out the investigation into different jurisdictions. So if Trump goes ballistic and fires Robert Mueller or fires Rod Rosenstein and tries to defang Mueller, if he tries to take away Mueller's security clearance, which would effectively make it impossible for Mueller to work, that there are other jurisdictions in which the prosecutions will proceed.
Craig Unger, can you tell me about the backstory of Paul Manafort and even going back to the 1980s when he was part of a firm called Black, Manafort and Stone? And the Stone part of that is none other than Roger Stone.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, it's wonderful watching Donald Trump say, oh, I barely knew Paul Manafort. He only worked for me for, I think at one point Trump said 49 days. Well, the truth is, he's known him at least 38 years. And in 1980, Manafort first began to work for Trump. And Manafort, this was Black Manafort Stone, the very firm you're talking about. And they helped Trump make some headway as he was trying to get into the gaming industry in New Jersey. At the time, that firm was very famous. There was a wonderful story in Spy magazine many, many years ago, at which it sort of satirized the whole thing because they were sort of known as the dictator's lobby or the torturer's lobby. And Roger Stone, who you mentioned, just reveled in the sleaze. He delighted in saying, we've got another sleazy dictator we're representing. And what happened to Manafort, Manafort kept taking it one or two steps further. And in 2006 and 2010, he represented Viktor Yanukovych, who became both president and at one time prime minister of Ukraine. And Yanukovych was very much a Putin puppet. He was installed in Ukraine by Putin.
He did win the election, though.
He did win, but he was, you know, he's been exiled and called a traitor and fled and was forced out of office. And there were a lot of accusations of fraud. And we also saw a huge number of dirty tricks on the part of Manafort back then. He started creating phony think tanks and planting fraudulent articles in various newspapers that would help Yanukovych and Putin's cause. And this, in many ways, to me, was almost a dry run for putting another pro-Putin president in place. There are an awful lot of peas in it. and that happened to be in 2016 when he puts President Trump in the White House. Who again appears to be doing Vladimir Putin's bidding.
Paul Manafort's a really interesting character once you get into his story. I almost see him as this decade's own version of a Jack Abramoff, even in the importance that he had in the lobbying world going back even to the 1980s. My understanding about Paul Manafort is that he got his rise by connecting himself to the campaign of Ronald Reagan and the presidency for Ronald Reagan, and that he was one of the young lobbyists at the time that changed the lobbying game. Whereas before, what a lobbyist do is what I think we still think they do is they would lobby for some special interests and the goals of that special interest and go into Congress and lobby lawmakers for that interest and what that interest wants. But what Paul Manafort did was he aligned lawmakers with that interest. In other words, meaning he would start working with grooming candidates for office to where there's already the connection between the candidate and that special interest, which may seem like a subtle distinction, but probably an important one.
Yes, no, I think it is a paradigmatic change. And I mean, his greatest triumph, of course, is you talk about a candidate aligned with a lobbyist's interest. Donald Trump is aligned with Putin's interests. And you can almost see this whole scandal in terms that are legal. I mean, you know, there's a wonderful maxim that sometimes the biggest scandals are the things that are legal, not illegal. And you mentioned Jack Abramoff, and it certainly goes back. This goes back easily to the 90s that Russians understood our lobbying system, and they and as you say, the special interest in the past might have been big oil or the big pharmaceutical industries. Well, now it's Vladimir Putin, and Manafort has been lobbying for those kinds of interests, and the candidate he helped install is Donald Trump.
And Paul Manafort would become an important lobbyist for foreign governments in the 1990s. With the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Right. And we, you know, one thing I started to do in this, I started to see the Cold War in very, very different terms. And that is, at the end, everyone assumes we won the Cold War, and it ended with the demise of the Soviet Union. But if you read my book, you can see that the KGB was sort of laying in wait. They were laying low, waiting to see how things sorted out. And Russia took enormous blows during this period. Putin has said again and again that the demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe in world history. And after that, one East Bloc country after another joined NATO. But Russia was laying low. The KGB was laying low. And in my book, you sort of see the KGB starting corporations that trade in commodities and so forth. But they are multi-billion-dollar corporations. But they really intend to serve Russian intelligence interests when Russia, the sleeping bear of Russia, reawakens. And that's what's happened now.
And one last note on Paul Manafort here. So then he goes into lobbying for foreign governments, gets and becomes – he's just not a lobbyist with Viktor Yanukovych. My understanding is for Viktor Yanukovych. He's the guy. Paul Manafort's basically grooming him in order to be president. But then when Viktor Yanukovych gets thrown out of office, which was done by undemocratic means with a civilian uprising, then Paul Manafort's financial situation just falls off a cliff. And now he becomes broke. And I guess he was making a tremendous amount of money from Ukraine. And then when that happens, that's when we get into the tax fraud and also in the banking fraud, because he's trying to figure out how to manage his life after this dramatic decrease in wealth. And then he even volunteers to and he does for free, works for Donald Trump, which is very suggestive of what he was planning in the future there if Trump were to win the presidency.
Absolutely. And he'd been making enormous amounts of money from Russia. He was getting $10 million a year.
Is that normal for a foreign lobbyist?
That's an awful lot. I went back in time, and it's not like a huge company he's running. This is a small shop, and we saw the reporting during the Manafort trial of exactly how extravagantly he was living. He was hanging out with Yanukovych at this billion-dollar estate that Yanukovych had. And when you get into the world of those oligarchs, I think Manafort became completely seduced about it, and I got into it. And you enter this world that is so decadent and so lurid. It's just extraordinary. I write about one scene where you see a 200-foot yacht cruise into a party, then a 300-foot yacht, and then a 500-foot yacht. And one of the yachts had 29 bar stools that were upholstered in the hides of a different endangered species. And I just sort of blew me away how decadent and lurid this is. I mean, you see these multi-billionaire oligarchs going after endangered species. Meanwhile, their staff is trying to procure various women and so forth. It's extraordinary.
We are in conversation with Craig Unger. Craig Unger is a veteran journalist. He is editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He's the author of a number of books. Yeah.
I just want to correct for 1 minute. Well, I was editor-in-chief. That was a while back. I'm in New York now.
Very good. Okay. So former editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. You are the author of a number of books, including your latest House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Craig Unger, let's now dive into the story of Donald Trump and his connection to Russia. And you write that this we can trace this as far back as 1978 when he and Ivana Trump, his previous wife, shortly after they were married, went to Czechoslovakia.
Right. People forget this started during the Cold War. This was still the height of the Cold War. And Ivana has been sort of forgotten in this saga, but obviously she came from Czechoslovakia. And the Czech secret police began interviewing her father quite a bit. They tried to interview her. They were keeping an eye on him, and this was reported directly to the KGB. And when I looked at the files, one of the interesting things in it that struck me was they said that Donald Trump was being pressured to run for president. It's an interesting word. Again, this is from the old Soviet Union. And I interviewed a former Soviet general in the KGB, Oleg Kalugin. Kalugin had been head of counterintelligence. He had actually been Vladimir Putin's boss at one point, which is sort of interesting. But Kalugin was telling me about all this, and he said, and I just want to read one quote he told me. He told me how Russians really set up Trump's first visit to Moscow. And it started in 1986 when the Russian ambassador Dubinin met with Trump. He broke with protocol and just met with Trump in Trump's office in Trump Tower. He brought his daughter along and said how marvelous he thought Trump Tower was and they should build something like that in Moscow. And they started seducing him and they finally invited him to Moscow. And during this,
I want to get into that because this is obviously important. But I don't want to lose sight of why were they interested in him in the first place, and why does this go back to Czechoslovakia? And does his wife Ivana have anything to do with this?
Well, I don't know. We don't have any reason to think Ivana was cooperating with them. But this was the Cold War.
But were they interested in Ivana? The intelligence agencies.
Perhaps as a way of putting pressure on Trump. They saw Trump was a person of interest because he was a influential businessman. And initially, when I talked to Oleg Kalugin, he said that America was a paradise for a Russian spy and that they had about 300 spies. So Trump was just one of many initially. But Ivana would have been a way of putting pressure on him. She had relatives; her father and mother were still there, and so she had. So they were going to be pressuring her father and perhaps Ivana herself for information. Now, the fact that they were able to pressure them, that is what interests me. And the first hint of that I was able to uncover took place in 1987. They had invited Trump to Russia. The trip was arranged by Intourist, was a Soviet travel agency completely wired into the KGB. Whether Trump was aware of that or not, I do not know. But it meant his travel plans and his hotel plans were effectively being set up by the KGB, and he was being monitored by them when he was in Russia.
You write that The Soviet Union had a long relationship with informants in the United States, especially from the left, especially with people who may have ideological sympathies with the Soviet Union. But this during this period of time in the 1980s, they were adjusting their strategy to also try to get into their mix, into their realm, wealthy men like Donald Trump.
Right. This was definitely not because he was a ideological soul brother. And one of the things that was interesting was after his first visit, he wrote he had a full page ad in the New York Times, Washington Post, and Boston Globe. And Roger Stone said he had something to do with this. And it was a very bizarre foreign policy initiative, which was very anti-European, anti-NATO. And it's exactly what the Soviets wanted and very similar to what Donald Trump is doing today, and which is what Putin wants. So we saw this kind of policy materialize. I mean, it's a matter of public record. You can dig up these front pages on the internet, and in which you see Donald Trump putting forth almost a very pro-Russian, pro-Soviet foreign policy 30 years ago.
Talk to me. Okay, let's now get into Donald Trump's relationship in the 1980s with Soviet ambassador, I guess, to the United States, Yuri Dubinin.
Right. Well, Yuri Dubinin, as I said, was the ambassador. He'd been both ambassador of the UN and the United States at various times. But he started, he and his daughter, without any appointment, just went to Trump Tower and they said, we want a Trump Tower in Moscow. And we will send you over there. And this began the trip to Moscow in 1987 that I just talked about.
And then he sets up a meeting, and Donald Trump very much wants to meet with Mikhail Gorbachev.
Right. And that never happened. I mean, it was sort of funny. He so wanted to meet with Gorbachev, and there was a Gorbachev impersonator who came into Trump Tower, and Donald Trump fell for it. Donald Trump even told the New York Times that he had met with Gorbachev, and the Times printed it, but it turned out that that was not true.
He never met with Gorbachev.
He never met with Gorbachev.
Okay. Why did he want to meet with Gorbachev?
He started to see himself in as a player on the world stage, and that's what you see starting to happen in the late and mid 80s. That he met with a Nobel Prize winner named Bernard Lown, and Lown was just flabbergasted that Trump thought he could solve the arms race when he knew absolutely nothing about it. There was a lot of ego going on there. I think to be a star in Russia and the United States was a big deal to him, and clearly it turns out he did have political ambitions. Not everyone knew it back then.
Talk to me. Also interesting, and I think we even see this somewhat in his presidency, especially with the negotiations with North Korea and Kim Jong-un. We see in the 1980s, Donald Trump becomes very concerned about nuclear disarmament.
Well, precisely. That's what he was talking with Professor Bernard Lown about, the Nobel Prize winner. And he fancied himself an expert on this. He said he could learn it all in an hour and a half. He was very smart. And he had an uncle who was a professor at MIT, and he talked with him one or two times. And Trump seemed to think that gave him the credentials to be an expert on nuclear arms. So he went out in public making all these with a whole new foreign policy that really ended up being pro-Russian, pro-Soviet.
So here in the 1980s, we're seeing the transformation of Donald Trump as a person, from just a businessman, a young guy, into somebody who wants to be a worldly statesman, even a politician.
Right. Right. And here in New York, however, that was never taken seriously. He was pretty much seen as a publicity seeking joke again and again and again. But the glitz of Trump Tower seemed to be dazzling on a national basis.
And there is even rumblings, I think, in 87, 88 of Donald Trump actually running for president, but but George Herbert Walker Bush was seen to be too strong for him to do.
Right. In 1988, he went so far as to actually go to New Hampshire and do some of the rituals that candidates do, appearing in various restaurants and so forth. And he was well received at the time, but it was clear he couldn't get the nomination, and he didn't run for president. He was also trying to get on the Reform Party ballot, and it became clear he would never get into the debates.
Yeah, and he would get on the Reform Party ballot in year 2000. Let's turn to the 1990s, because this is an important decade, I think, on the story that you are telling. And there are two concurrent things that are happening in the world. One, again, you have you have the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union and the deep economic crisis that strikes Russia at this time. At the same time, Donald Trump here in the United States, in New York City, is $4 billion in debt, and he's fighting for his financial life as well. Tell me about the importance of those two events.
Right. Well, Donald Trump has expanded into Atlantic City with three casinos that are immensely huge. The Taj Mahal was said to be the biggest casino in the world. I think it was a $1 billion casino. But it was competing against his other casinos, and he was vastly, vastly overextended, and eventually filed six bankruptcies. He was $4 billion in debt, and here's where you start to see the Russian mafia come to his rescue. And in 2002, and his whole model changed because he was so much in debt, he could never get a bank loan again. So he set up a new model where he is essentially franchising luxury condos. Think of it like McDonald's franchises fast food outlets. That's what he was doing. He was raising none of the money because he couldn't. He was just putting his name on the condos, and he would collect 18 to 25 royalties, which are enormously high in that business as a franchise fee. But he was a big enough showman, and his name did appear to have value, that he was getting that. What people didn't seem to notice was that so much of this money was coming from the Russians. And in fact, you know, the FBI was chasing one of the big Russian mobsters in 1992, a guy named Vaslav Ivankov, and they were looking all over Brooklyn for him because he was sort of running the Russian mafia in Brooklyn. And where did he live? It turned out he lived in Trump Tower, in the home of the President of the United States. So these relationships were very important to Trump. And it was actually after the 90s, in 2002, a firm called Bayrock took offices in Trump Tower. It's a real estate development company. And it also, it turns out, had many ties to the Russian mafia.
Now, you write that Donald Trump is a great beneficiary of money from Russian oligarchs. They also need Donald Trump because of the economic crisis and the great depreciation of the ruble that is happening at this time. They need to find somewhere to put their money.
Absolutely. You know, there's been over $1 trillion in flight capital from Russia since Vladimir Putin has been president. And you would think that would be disastrous for the Russian economy, and it is. But you know what? I think it's good enough for Vladimir Putin because he's getting a piece of it. And in a way, that's what this is all about, is Russia as a mafia state. And there was a wonderful book by Karen DeWisha called Putin's Kleptocracy that really explains it. And when you talk about Russia as a mafia state, Putin is in effect the capo. He is the head. He is the godfather. The Russian mafia is allowed to function so long as they serve his interests. And what you see that they've done with Trump is they set up a paradigm, a new business model that benefits Trump, where Trump is able to benefit by effectively allowing all his real estate properties to launder Russian money. That's what's been going on. And we think of this in broad historic terms. Russia needs to launder about $1 trillion. How are they going to do that? The very best way to do that, if you need to launder that much money, is through real estate. There are almost no regulations in real estate. You can buy a condo for $2, $3, $5, $50 million, all cash, no questions asked, anonymously, through a shell company. And Trump has done that, allowed that to happen at least 1,300 times with his properties in the United States alone. And he has many, many more properties overseas.
Well, you're right that they were able to use Trump's properties to take, quote unquote, dirty money and turn it into clean money. What does that mean?
If you sell your home, it's clean. People want to know where the money came from. It came from the sale of your home. It is clean. But where did the money come from originally? Trump and the Trump Organization said, well, we didn't know. It was sold by a broker. But it's been set up so there are deniability mechanisms so they don't look into it. They simply don't ask questions. And you see this happen, as I said, 1,300 times. There's a concept in law called willful ignorance, and I would suggest maybe I can't prove what Trump knows, that he knows he's selling real estate to the Russian mafia. But it seems to me if you benefit from something that happens 1,300 times in a row, you're probably going to figure out what's going on.
And this financially rescues him?
Absolutely. He, as I said, $4 billion in debt. Hundreds of millions of that was personal debt. But the banks figured his name did really have value. I mean, I'm no fan of President Trump's, but it did have market value. Absolutely.
I wasn't going to accuse you of being a fan of Donald Trump's. I can assure you of that. Your argument here is that it not only rescues Donald Trump financially, but also rescues his reputation and further even propels him into helping be this TV star, because then after all of this happens, we get the launch of the television program The Apprentice. And a major part of the narrative of Donald Trump in this show, The Apprentice, is that, and he even says it in the show, that, hey, I was in a lot of trouble. I was $4 billion in debt. I was in a lot of trouble, but I used my brain and I used my skills of making deals to be able to get me out of it. And I made myself into a new man, basically painting him as an emblem of the American dream.
Absolutely. But he left out, he got a little help from the Russian mafia. I think he omits that part.
Right. My point. But that's my point, though. I mean, this helps resuscitate him and put him back on the world stage as somebody who's a successful man.
Completely. Absolutely. And I think most people think he came back thanks to The Apprentice, but he could not have presented himself as being so successful if the Russian mafia had not come to his aid earlier.
Who is Semyon Mogilevich?
He's a fascinating figure, and you know, I have trouble with Russian names, and but this is one that is worth learning. Let me tell you, because
people did I get never, it wrong? If I pronounce it wrong,
no, you're pretty good. I say Mogilevich, and I'm not sure how good I am, but
Mogilevich.
But I also know that 18 years ago, no one had heard, few Americans knew who Osama bin Laden was, and suddenly he became a household name. And I believe Mogilevich plays a similarly important role. He is known as the brains behind the Russian mafia. And, you know, in Russia, there's no Wall Street, there's no Goldman Sachs. And if you have any financial acumen, you want to work with the Russian mafia. And Mogilevich is at the very top. He's one of the top three or four leaders. He's probably not the most powerful person, but he's responsible for the all their spectacular financial scams. And I go into a lot of them in the book, but you see how he's making so much money that it has to be laundered. And Mogilevich is a master of money laundering. And in my book, you can see that he is close to Putin. I found transcripts from Ukrainian intelligence of secretly recorded conversations in which the Ukrainian president talks about Mogilevich's ties to Vladimir Putin, and you see that they have arrangements. And these arrangements are crucial because, you know, in the end, we all want to know, where does the money come from? And these are arrangements with Russia is a poor country, but its natural resources are being seized by the oligarchs and by Russian mafioso. And through Mogilevich, we see nearly $1 billion a year being skimmed from the Ukrainian energy trade. And that becomes a money pipeline. Some of it goes to Paul Manafort. Some of it may be going to finance some of these buildings, these condos. But there is money being skimmed off from the Ukrainian energy trade, and also from the aluminum trade, from oligarchs in the aluminum trade, and that is going into Trump properties.
I think of former KGB spy Alexander Litvinenko, who will remember defected to London and then was killed through poison in 2005. Is my understanding correct? One of the things that he was telling British investigators, what was about this relationship between Mogilevich and Putin?
Absolutely. And it's one of the reasons I include Litvinenko, because what you see is, I mean, on the Putin side of the ledger, you see how does Putin goes from being he was a deputy city councilor in St. Petersburg and suddenly becomes the most powerful man in the world. And I wondered, how did that happen? And I started to look at his at Putin's ties to the mafia. And, you know, you go back to when he was a teenager and he was practicing judo. And judo is enormously important to Vladimir Putin. Putin's coach was a mobster. And some of his sparring partners are the oligarchs of today. The Rundberg brothers, for example, are multi-billionaires. I looked at Putin's sparring partners and the ones I could find, their average net worth. These are guys who sparred in judo with Putin when he was a teenager. Their average net worth was around $6 billion. Which means I would took the wrong sport in high school, I think.
Craig Unger is our guest. Craig Unger is a veteran journalist. He's former editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He's the author of such books as He is the author of such books as House of Bush, House of Saud. His latest book that we are talking about is called House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Craig Unger, we see a number of presidential bids by Donald Trump throughout his career over since year 2000. None of them are taken very seriously. Even the 2016 one wasn't taken very seriously at first. It wasn't taken seriously, and perhaps till it was too late. Do you see connections with Russian oligarchs and Donald Trump in his previous presidential runs?
It's not as clear early on. What I see is more that they are helping him financially. They are targeting him. They're setting him up, and I see him as being very easy prey, to be honest. When I talked to General Oleg Kalugin, He told me about Trump's first trip to Russia. And remember, Kalugin was with the KGB back then. And Kalugin told me, and I'm going to quote this, is I would not be surprised if the Russians have, and Trump knows about it, files on him during his trip to Russia. He's referring to 1987 and his involvement with meeting young ladies who were controlled by Russian intelligence.
Even talking about the Christopher Steele dossier with that.
Right. This is nearly 30 years earlier. So I think, you know, I did try to investigate the Steele dossier, and I found that Steele had an excellent reputation. I found that again and again. This is a different episode, so I can't say it's corroborating what Steele found, but it is it's sort of corollary evidence that is supportive because it's very, very similar.
And of course, the Steele dossier is now very controversial. People try to discredit it. We don't know the truth of it yet as of now, one way or the other. But what this KGB general told you was this kind of activity of what Russian intelligence services would do when somebody would visit the country is actually was very, very common.
Right. If you look at the whole narrative and look at Donald Trump's ties to Russia, again, I found 59 contacts, 59 different people. If you see it through a 30-year prism, you see that they're setting him up. And it always starts with a casual conversation. That's what General Kalugin told me. They start by flattering him. And believe me, Donald Trump is susceptible to flattery. He says so himself. So they told him, oh, you did such a wonderful building in New York. Let's do it in Moscow. And then when he gets there, they provide him, according to Kalugin, they provide him with women and they're secretly taping everything. That's the way it begins.
And that's, again, that's normal practice. So we'll have to see. Do you think we ever get to the bottom of the Steele dossier? Do you ever think we ever find out with your investigations into it, what it's accurate, if it's accurate or not?
You know, I think it's going to take a couple of years for everything to unfold. We may not get all the answers. I will tell you this. To me, I have a great deal of respect for Christopher Steele. What I initially thought was the most preposterous allegation was he reported that Donald Trump was funneling intelligence to Russian intelligence. And I thought that was ridiculous because I think Trump is one of the least disciplined people in the world. And I couldn't imagine how he was funneling intelligence there. But when you look at the real estate company Bayrock that Trump partnered with, it's in Trump Tower. Think of where they're raising their money from. They put together at one point nearly $2 billion. Hundreds of millions of it certainly came from Russian sources. It went through Icelandic banks that are known to launder Russian money, and that helped build buildings like the Trump Soho. And there are court cases going over this again and again. Then once they were built, individual condos were sold to Russian oligarchs and wealthy Russians. So this is one way intelligence can flow from Donald Trump to Moscow. They know where the money's coming from. They can Putin wants to keep track of his oligarchs and where the money is. Bayrock would know this, and Trump's operations with Bayrock, partnering them would have that information as well.
And that would get us to something you already mentioned, and that's plausible deniability by Donald Trump. If he actually knew whether or not his businesses were and his properties were being used to funnel this money.
Right. I mean, he can set it up in a way where he doesn't have to know. I described the first act of money laundering in which Trump simply doesn't ask questions. All he has to do is tell his lawyers or his subordinates, if we can get top dollar for this, go ahead and don't ask too many questions. And that's what he's been doing.
And that gets to the whole heart of, I think, what all of this attention concerning the 2016 election and the controversies around it is the We see many circumstantial, I guess we see a lot of circumstantial evidence, but what we're missing, that smoking gun, aren't we?
Well, in a way we are, but in a way I think everything is hiding in plain sight. And I'm not a lawyer and I don't have subpoena power and there are documents I can't get and so forth. But look at the whole, think about racketeering. Think about ongoing criminal enterprises. Think about money laundering. It's very, very hard to prove what is in his mind. I think there are a number of crimes, potential crimes here. One thing, the one place where I was able to get inside Donald Trump's mind, if that's accurate, is he gave sworn depositions under oath in a trial in which he said he knew about, he was asked about Felix Sater, who he partnered with, and Sater had been convicted of two felonies. So from that deposition, we know that Trump was knowledgeable that he was partnering with a felon, and he continued to conceal that fact from investors, and he ended up profiting from this. That can be bank fraud. It's a possible case for bank fraud. So there are a lot of questions that need to be explored legally.
I really wish that Democrats wouldn't take off the table. And who knows if they actually mean this or not, but at least in the campaigns for the midterm, took off the issue of an impeachment. And the reason I say that, not even necessarily to remove Donald Trump from office, I would just like to see impeachment, because impeachment doesn't remove Donald a president from office. It starts a trial in the Senate. I, for one, would love to see a trial over all this, where both sides are able to lay out and scrutinize all the evidence that's out there over all of this.
Absolutely. I think the magnitude of this can't be overstated, and it's going to require nationally televised hearings that go on day after day after day, where people like Felix Sater become household names, or Michael Cohen become household names, and people understand the narrative over the last 30 years. I think this is one of those great points in history that is almost I call the first chapter a virtual world war. And by that, I mean it's a war without bombs or bullets or boots on the ground, and it uses other weapons like disinformation, hacking, cyber warfare, manipulation of the media, just lies and various covert operations and so forth. And I think it has not become unraveled yet. I mean, people are starting, have only seen the tip of the iceberg. This is much, much deeper. It's really a geopolitical battle between Russia and the United States. Putin has been very, very successful in manipulating Trump. And a lot of it goes to the enormous amounts of flight capital and Trump being the recipient of that and the beneficiary of it.
Yeah, I just think a trial, because again, everything is contested. All of the facts, even whether or not the hack came from Russia or not, it's all contested. If we had a trial in the Senate, because I think that's the only place this would actually happen, would be then, okay, let's lay out the facts and let's hear experts talk about these things and get into it. Craig Unger, as we move to wrap up here, let me ask you about Felix Sater, because you mentioned his name. You said his name should be a household a name that everybody knows of, but I have yet to actually ask you about him specifically. Who is he?
Well, I call him the international man of mystery in one of my chapters. And to be honest, I have a lot of questions about Felix Sater. I have talked to him. I don't have all the answers. But he moved here in the 70s as a kid with his father, who was said to be tied up with the Russian mafia. And he also worked with the Italian mafia in Brighton Beach. Felix was convicted twice of felonies, once in a bar fight, once in a pump and dump stock scandal. And he started, he was friendly with Michael Cohen going back to the 80s. And he started working with Bayrock, which was this real estate development company I mentioned, and Felix was the managing director of it, and was working with Trump a lot. Trump has denied, has said he barely knows Felix. That's simply not the case. They traveled together quite a bit. Felix accompanied Ivanka and Don Jr., Trump's children, on their first trip to Moscow. But most importantly, he worked with Bayrock, and he also moved over partnering with Trump in the firms in the buildings I discussed earlier. And he continued to try to develop Trump Tower with Trump right up through the election in 2016. So through Sater, Trump was having contacts in Moscow right up through the election. And some of those contacts are very, very interesting, as they involve companies that appear to be tied to the Russian mafia.
Craig Unger has been our guest. Craig Unger is a veteran journalist. He's the author of a number of books. His latest is called House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Craig Unger, I thank you greatly for taking this hour to join us today. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. You can find archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. How is climate change affecting the recent heat waves? At the end of July 2018, climatesignals.org brought together three eminent climate scientists via Skype. They exchanged ideas on the impacts of global warming as they are now, quote, playing out in real time. Mike Mann is director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University. Jennifer Francis is research professor at Rutgers University's Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. And Noah Diffenbaugh is the Kara J. Foundation professor at Stanford University. They discuss the recent heat waves around the globe and how they connect with a changing jet stream pattern. First to comment is Professor Michael Mann. Dr. Mann is author of more than 200 peer-reviewed publications, numerous op-eds and commentaries, and four books, including Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change, and The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. Here's his response to the question, how is climate change affecting the recent heat waves? He's followed by Professor Jennifer Francis.
I'm happy to take the first stab at that. You know, it's not rocket science. You make the Earth hotter, you're going to have more extreme heat. You're going to have longer periods of extreme heat. You're going to have more intense heat. And that's what we're seeing. And it's not surprising that as we continue to warm the planet, as we continue to put these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, so make the planet warmer, you're going to have more prolonged periods of intense heat. You're going to have more extreme heat. And that's what we're seeing this summer. The impacts of climate change are no longer subtle. We're seeing them play out in real time. And what's happening this summer is an excellent example. When you look at the intense heat, the unprecedented wildfires, floods, droughts. Now, there are other mechanisms that may be at work here as well. It isn't just that a hotter planet is going to produce more frequent and intense periods of heat, but we may be changing the circulation of the atmosphere. And our own research suggests that climate change, and in particular, the melting of Arctic sea ice and the warming of the Arctic, is actually changing the jet stream in a way that leads to more persistent extreme meanders in the jet stream in the summer. And that gives us these blocking high-pressure systems where we see intense heat. It gives us these troughs, these low-pressure areas that stay put day after day, giving us excessive rainfall and extreme flooding. So it isn't just the fact that a warmer planet is warmer. It's also changing the atmospheric circulation in a way that may be giving us these very persistent extreme events.
So I would just jump in and add that over the last week and maybe longer, we've seen the exact kinds of patterns that Mike is describing, where we've had this very undulating jet stream in place with big north-south swings all around the northern hemisphere, particularly over the continents. And it's tough to relate it directly to what's going on in the Arctic, but it's certainly consistent with what Mike is describing. In addition to those big undulations, we've also seen the jet stream split over North America and over Europe. And if you look at a map of the jet stream today or any time over the last week or two, you'll see that this split characteristic has been there. And when I say split, I mean part of it is going to the north and traveling along the basically the coast of the Arctic, and the other part is farther south. And some of Mike's research and his colleagues have suggested that when the jet stream does this split type of a feature, it tends to trap the weather patterns, the weather systems between those splits, and makes them very stagnant and persistent. And they've connected that to a lot of the most extreme events that we've seen over the last couple of decades. That kind of mechanism seems to be playing a role and increasing over time.
That was Dr. Jennifer Francis, research professor at Rutgers University Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. Her research interests are the connections between rapid Arctic warming and weather patterns in mid-latitudes, particularly extreme weather events, causes and impacts of Arctic sea ice loss, and the link to accelerated melt of the Greenland ice sheet. Next up is Noah Diffenbaugh, Kara J. Foundation professor at Stanford University. He studies and writes about the climate system, including processes by which climate change could impact agriculture, water resources, and human health. Dr. Diffenbaugh is currently editor-in-chief of the peer-reviewed journal Geophysical Research Letters.
One of the real threats of heat waves is not just the very hot temperatures that we see in the daytime, but the fact that night temperatures don't drop to comfortable levels, to levels that allow us to sleep comfortably. It actually becomes a severe health threat, especially for the elderly and the young. When temperatures just don't cool down, your body doesn't have a chance to recuperate from the extreme heat that you've experienced during the daytime. We just set a record in North Africa for the highest low temperature, the highest nighttime minimum temperature on record, 109 degrees Fahrenheit. That was the lowest temperature that was seen in a location in Africa. And 109 degrees Fahrenheit is hot enough just as a daytime maximum temperature, but that was a nighttime minimum temperature. That is a real health threat, obviously. We have difficulty coping with that sort of extreme heat, especially when it stays warm throughout the night, like it's doing this summer in many regions.
And especially in countries that don't have access generally to cooling, air conditioning, or, you know, any relief from that kind of a heat.
So I think one thing that, you know, is important to keep in mind as these individual events unfold, one is that as scientists, we're, you know, very careful to diagnose each event individually and the conditions that create each event individually. And overall, globally, what we're seeing is exactly what has been predicted for decades. So the warming of the planet as a whole is leading to warming of individual regions. The warming of those individual regions is upping the odds that when heat waves happen, that they're hotter, more severe. It's upping the odds that the atmospheric and ocean conditions that create heat waves, when those conditions occur, that they produce more severe events, in some cases more prolonged events. This is the warming of the nighttime temperatures, you know, that we're seeing. This is also a very robust prediction of a warming climate. So these are all at the global scale, you know, what we should expect, and in fact what has been predicted for decades. So not only is it consistent with global warming, but it's exactly what has been forecast.
Yeah, to add to that, it's sort of troubling as a scientist when you're studying this major threat, the threat of human-caused climate change. It's disconcerting in a sense to see our predictions coming true, because of course we warned of this decades ago, and had we acted on climate change decades ago, we wouldn't be seeing the extreme and dangerous weather events around the world that we're seeing this summer. So that's a huge lost opportunity, the fact that we didn't act on this problem decades ago when we knew it was emerging. The good news is that there is still time to avert even more catastrophic impacts on climate change, even more deadly extreme weather events. But obviously, we have to act now. We have to shift away from fossil fuels to renewable energy.
And I would just add to that that some of the impacts of these extreme events are unfolding and starting to affect people and the ecosystem in very expensive and damaging ways. So if there's any silver lining to this dark cloud, it would be that I think more and more people now are recognizing that the impacts are affecting them personally, and that more and more we can connect what's going on to the changing climate system. So every poll that I see that comes out that measures what fraction of the population, especially in the United States, believes whether climate change is having an impact and whether humans are causing it, that number keeps growing. And I think it's partly because of these damaging extreme events, and it's costing people money, it's costing people lives, it's costing their own property, and climate change is affecting people today. It's not this distant problem for their grandchildren.
Yeah, I mean, who are you going to believe? The climate change denying talking head on Fox News or your own two eyes?
Those eyes have to be open, however.
That's right. And that's what we're all trying to do, make sure that people do open their eyes.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to a conversation between three climate scientists, recorded by Skype on July 27, 2018. They are Mike Mann, Director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University, Jennifer Francis, Research Professor at Rutgers University's Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences, and Noah Diffenbaugh, Kara J. Foundation Professor at Stanford University. The discussion was organized by Climate Signals and moderated by Markea Thomas. Here's her next question about the media. Michael Mann is the first to respond.
So what's something reporters don't understand about heat waves?
It's easy to comprehend, to understand that as you warm up the planet, you're going to get more intense heat. But that's just sort of the simple part of the problem. In reality, climate change, as we've talked about, is also changing the behavior of the jet stream. It's changing the atmospheric circulation. It may be leading to more of these blocking high pressure systems that remain stationary. And that's when you get unprecedented heat spells. When the same high pressure region covers Europe or North America day after day, and the sun continues to bake those regions, that's when you get unprecedented heat waves. And so it's really a few different things working together. Just the fact that higher global temperatures mean more intense heat periods, more extended periods of heat, and the fact that we're changing the pattern of the atmospheric flow in a way that gives us those stagnant air masses that are associated with unprecedented heat, like what we've seen in Europe this week.
I think also humans have been measuring temperature for a long time. So, from thermometers in different parts of the world, and we've now had satellites orbiting the planet for, about almost four decades, returning, measurements of temperature around the world essentially continuously. And so scientists now have a very long record of measurements of temperature. And what that means is that we can analyze long-term trends, not only in the global temperature, but in the temperature of different parts of the world. And as a result of those very rich, comprehensive observations, we can now test hypotheses about how global warming potentially influences individual extreme events around the world. And what we find, you know, when scientists conduct those objective, skeptical analyses, testing those rigorous hypotheses, what we find is that global warming has already put a thumb on the scale for a number of different kinds of extremes. Around the world, we find a human fingerprint of global warming at more than 80% of the surface area of the globe for the hottest temperature on record. And so for the hottest heat event, global warming has already put a thumb on the scale at more than 80% of the world. So we're not yet at the point where every single record hot event clearly has a human fingerprint, but we're getting awfully close.
Let me add one cautionary note here. You know, the sort of work that NOAA and other scientists have done in attempting to attribute to human activity of these extreme events is very important work. And it has helped inform our understanding of how climate change is indeed stacking the deck towards these more extreme events. But those analyses, of course, can be no better than the models that are used to conduct them. And climate models have come a long way, and there's reason to take their predictions very seriously. But there are certain areas where the models may not be as reliable as other areas. And one of those areas does have to do with the behavior of the jet stream, and in particular, this phenomenon that my colleagues and I have been studying that's called planetary wave resonance, but it has to do with the fact that under certain circumstances, the jet stream can undulate more wildly than normal. You get larger meanders in the jet stream, and those meanders are very stable. They don't lose energy, and so they build, and they can sort of stay in place day after day. And you get these very persistent weather events, very persistent low pressure areas with extreme rainfall, very persistent high pressure regions with extreme heat, and they stay in the same location day after day. Our analyses suggest that the state-of-the-art climate models used, for example, in the most recent assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, are not yet at the point where we can actually diagnose this phenomenon in the models themselves. We have to turn to other alternative approaches, more process-based approaches, to understand how climate change may be impacting those types of phenomena. And our own analyses suggest that because of that, the models may be overly conservative. When we use the models to assess the human impact on extreme weather events, they may not be capturing, in fact, we're fairly confident that they're not capturing, this other component that is adding to the increase in these extreme weather events.
And I would just follow up with the original question that you asked about what the media doesn't understand completely, perhaps, and that is, it goes back to what Mike was describing, how when you've got one kind of extreme in one place around the Northern Hemisphere, most likely you're going to find extremes of other types also occurring at the same time because of these undulations that happen in the jet stream. So those waves in the jet stream, those north-south swings in the jet stream, are what create the weather around the Northern Hemisphere that we all experience down at the surface. And when it's crazy and bizarre in one place, say a heat wave in one area, you can bet that somewhere else it's overly cold, which in the summer doesn't get reported because everybody's happy about that. But you'll also find areas that are getting persistent rain, and that's been happening, for example, along the Atlantic seaboard. You know, Washington, D.C. has been pretty much underwater for the last couple of weeks. So I think that's something that the media doesn't really understand too well yet, but I think, you know, we're working on you, and I think, you know, more and more we're finding some of the journalists that we talk to often are really understanding this now.
Yeah, I would add to that just some specific examples of what Jen was describing. When you have these very unusual jet stream patterns, you have unusual weather that's correlated around the entire hemisphere. And while Japan was experiencing record flooding, parts of Europe and North America were experiencing record heat. In 2010, when Moscow had this unprecedented heat and these unprecedented wildfires, Pakistan was experiencing their worst flooding on record. That isn't a coincidence. It's because these perturbations in the jet stream have a hemispheric scale, and we see extreme weather all around the entire Northern Hemisphere, like we are seeing this July.
That was Professor Michael Mann adding to the intriguing question, of how the meanders of the jet stream affect our weather. Next up is moderator Markea Thomas with her last question.
And what would you like to see covered more in the media? What should they be talking about?
Well, I think Jennifer just made an excellent point. It's the fact that these aren't coincidences. These aren't isolated coincidences that we're seeing these extreme weather events all around the Northern Hemisphere right now, this summer. It's part of a coherent change in the atmospheric circulation that almost certainly has a climate change component to it. What is good is that we are seeing the media start to connect the dots when it comes to climate change and extreme weather. The extreme weather we're seeing right now this summer, clearly we can see the fingerprint of human activity in these extreme weather events. And some media outlets have connected the dots. Too many have not. In fact, there was an analysis last week that looked at sort of the prestige press and the legacy media, sort of our main media outlets in the United States. And very few of them actually commented on climate change as they covered these unprecedented extreme weather events. We've got to get better at that. We have to bring the journalistic community along in recognizing that they do have a responsibility to connect those dots, because that's where the rubber hits the road. When it comes to the threat of climate change, the damage that's being done by climate change, we have to understand that it isn't some subtle, far-off problem, polar bears in the Arctic. It is destruction and loss of life and massive upheaval where we live today, associated with extreme weather events that have been made more extreme by climate change.
And I would just add, I think it's a huge communication opportunity as well, because the public loves to hear about extreme weather. I mean, it's everybody loves talking about the weather. The headlines are the extremes, the damage, and so forth. Then if you can make that connection to some aspect of climate change in, you know, a reasonable way, in some way that, you know, doesn't extend the science too far, it's that opportunity to connect with the public, because you've already got them listening with the extremes that are happening. And then you can slide a little spinach into the cheeseburger, is how I like to think of it. So the cheeseburger is the extreme event. Everybody loves that. And then you just slip a little spinach in there and you educate the public gradually about how science is learning that what you just witnessed as an extreme event does have this component that's contributed by climate change.
Let me just riff briefly off of the eloquent statement by Jennifer. Not only can we talk about the weather, we can actually do something about it.
Yeah.
We can do something about the path that we're on towards more extreme and deadly weather events. We can change that path by acting on climate change.
Perfect. Thank you. Again, thank you for joining us. There has been a lot of good, very solid information shared today. And for more information about heat waves and extreme heat, head to climatesignals.org and be sure to follow Climate Signals on Twitter.
You heard a conversation among three climate scientists recorded by Skype on July 27, 2018. They were Mike Mann, Director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University, Jennifer Francis, Research Professor at Rutgers University's Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences, and Noah Diffenbaugh, KRJ Foundation Professor at Stanford University. The discussion was organized by climatesignals.org and moderated by Markea Thomas. On the next program by TUC Radio, you will hear a solo lecture by Professor Jennifer Francis on crazy weather and the Arctic meltdown. How are they connected? She spoke at the New England Aquarium in the fall 2017 lecture season. Here's a short preview.
So I focused mainly on the Arctic itself, how it was changing, why it was changing. And it's really only in the last 5 years that I've started to focus my research on not just the Arctic meltdown, which I'm going to talk about a lot tonight, but also how it's connected to our weather patterns. We're changing the Arctic so much and so fast that I thought there's got to be an impact on the rest of the circulation system. and affecting our weather patterns here. But the really tricky question is how these two things are connected to each other. So that's what I'm going to try to explain to you tonight. I'm sure you're all well aware that Mother Nature has just gone berserk in the last few years. We've seen all kinds of extreme weather events transpiring all over the Northern Hemisphere. The coast of the UK has had some of the worst winters they've ever had in the last few years, just bombarded by storm after storm after storm. There are places in northern Japan where they're used to getting a fair bit of snow, but in this particular winter of 2012, they had more snow than they've ever had. Last summer, we had record flooding in Louisiana and many other places. We all remember that crazy winter of 2015, right? Record-breaking snow in Boston, which is saying a lot. And in Europe, they had a heck of a summer with all kinds of heat waves in central part of Europe, southern Europe, a lot of forest fires, while the UK and Scandinavia had an incredibly wet, cold summer. So all those examples all had something in common. These are all the types of extreme events that have to do with weather patterns that have become persistent. They've become stuck. All right, so I want to step back first and kind of set the stage a little bit here. I'm sure most of you here are very aware of the fact that our climate is changing. Well, you've probably heard from some people that are a little bit skeptical of what's going on right now that the climate has always changed, and this is just a natural cycle. Well, let's take a look at that. Here we are looking at two graphs, two curves here. The red is what the Earth's temperature has been doing over the last 400,000 years or so. All right? You can clearly see that it's been up and down over that time period. And those ups and downs in temperature, we understand very well what caused those. It's because of shifts in the Earth's orbit around the sun. And they're very regular. When the temperature's warm back then, that's when we had what we call an interglacial period, when the Earth was warm. And when it gets colder, and you'll notice it's only several degrees that separates those, that was an ice age. So the Earth has fluctuated back and forth between these warm periods and ice ages. Along with that, the blue curve there is showing you how much carbon dioxide there was in the atmosphere at the same time. And you'll see that they're very closely related to each other. Until you get to the present time, here we are with over 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now. You can see it's nothing like it's been in approximately 500,000 years. We are completely off the chart, and we know exactly where that carbon dioxide came from. It came from mostly burning fossil fuels. What you may also notice is that the temperature hasn't caught up with that carbon dioxide yet. There's a big lag in the system. We put that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere so fast that the Earth has not had time to catch up to being in equilibrium with that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But one thing we do know is the last time we saw carbon dioxide levels this high, which was many millions of years ago, we know that the globe was several degrees warmer than it is now, and we know that sea levels were tens of feet higher. So this is where we're going.
That was Dr. Jennifer Francis, research professor at Rutgers University Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. Her research interests are the connections between rapid Arctic warming and weather patterns in mid-latitudes, and the impacts of Arctic sea ice loss on accelerated melt of the Greenland ice sheet. For the full lecture, please tune in when TUC Radio returns next week. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The individual is a fallacy, and it is so embedded in our daily activities and our daily talk that we use it without really challenging the notion of the individual.
That's the voice of Marcelo Saavedra. On this week's show, we speak to Marcelo. Stay tuned.
I am very privileged to have with us Dr. Marcelo Saavedra. He's an Aymara elder, and he's joining us from Ottawa. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Sylvia. Thank you so much.
I love the story of creation. We are speaking with Dr. Marcelo Saavedra. He's an Aymara elder. And as you take us to the creation of Turtle Island.
That's why they call this territory Akiminak Limitik, which means the back of the turtle. You know, and many people don't know why they call it like that. And it is because, one, it looks, I mean, when you see the territory at large with a satellite photograph, for instance, you're going to see that it looks like a turtle very much. You just have to believe that it is a turtle to see it. And it is not, as the Europeans say, I have to see it to believe it. It's the opposite. I have to believe it to see it. So if you believe in it, you are going to see the turtle. You know, and actually, I'm creating a constitutional kit in which we actually draw a geographical map, and then on top we draw the turtle. And if it's perfect, it's like the territory is a turtle. As you go through the back of the turtle, you find that any turtle, for this matter, has 13 shells, inner central shells. There are 13. And on the sides of the big shell, there is also 26 smaller shells. And this represents the council of grandmothers and the council of grandfathers. And the central shells, which are also 13, they represent the social order that they have to follow. The story, the myth of creation, because it becomes more complex, it actually allows you to create a social order by following the 7 teachings that I mentioned before, and that you get to live in equilibrium and in harmony with Mother Earth.
By what you said, that the animals had to remember their covenants, they have remembered their instructions. What are those instructions? Remind us, what are the key teachings of our grandfathers?
Teachings that were kept by our ancestors, they had a fractal design. So just by knowing a bunch of them, a subset of them, you can actually derive the other teachings, because we haven't completely forgotten our original instructions. We can still remember them if we are humble, if we are honest, if we are respectful, if we are brave, if we are wise, if we love our relations, and if we are truthful. Those are, I just mentioned, the 7 teachings of the 7 grandfathers. If we follow those values, we are going to live a life that tends to be in equilibrium and tends to be in harmony with Mother Earth. And when I say Mother Earth, I'm also referring to the cosmos, because we believe in a parity fashion. We know that the planet is not alone in her orbit. It comes along with the solar system, you know, and it also comes with the sun, which we call Tata Inti, Father Sun. That's a parity as well, fundamental parity. And also, actually, our universe, it comes also paired up with what they say it's dark energy, which makes up about 72 to 75% of what there is in this cosmos. So everything is like in a parity relation, like everything. We have just forgotten that, and we believe this illusion of individuals, of things expressing themselves as individual things, and that's only an illusion. It's not real. Like everything comes, you come surrounded by your relations. It's metakuye oyasin in the Lakota language, you know. And of course, you find not the same teachings are not expressed in the same way, because these teachings, they pertain more to Turtle Islanders. In the South, in my culture, you find other teachings that actually complement and complete and the same as opposing the teachings of the people of the North, of Turtle Island. So we have a prophecy which is called the prophecy of the Pachacuti. Pachacuti means the cosmic upheaval. And this prophecy, I'm going to summarize it. It talks about the peoples, the indigenous peoples of Turtle Island and the indigenous peoples of the Tawantinsuyu and their power animals. Our power animal is the condor, and the power animal of the Turtle Islanders is the eagle. And this prophecy talks about a time when everything was going to be upside down and when we were going to meet again. People that are that represent the eagle and people that represent the condor. And when we met with Jacob, that's the first thing that came to our mind, because actually when I met him when he was performing the dance of the eagle. So I approached Jacob and I asked him, so you are dancing the dance of the eagle? And I know it because I have seen this dance in my territory, but being danced differently because it was the dance of the condor. And my elders explained to me that our peoples, they were going to meet again once the planet is going through a very profound crisis. And that's how I recognized Jacob. And since then, I walked with him for about 10 years, trying to remember our original instructions. And we did manage to remember like many, many of them. So, and for me, that was a magical period in my life when I was walking with Jacob, because we managed to find my constitution in the South, which is basically a constellation on the sky, and we managed to find the constitution of Turtle Islanders in the myth of creation of Turtle Island. And these two constitutions, they're also the myth of creation of our peoples. But then we went on and we started to search or to dig into the myth of creation of Mesoamerican people, or I should say of Anahuac people, because, you know, Latin America, North America, Mesoamerica, they are misnomers. Our original names, like this territory, is rather called Akiminak Nimitik, that its original name. In the South, its original name is Tawantinsuyu. And the whole of what they call the Americas is called the Adiyadra, you know. So those are their proper names, and that's how we should call them. Not only because they are the proper names, but because they are beautiful. They mean something, you know. And their names also, they leave you with a sense of that these things are alive, because they are. You know, Turtle Island is a turtle, it's alive. So the constitution, which is the back of the turtle, is also alive. It hasn't been killed yet by writing it down. It's still like orally passed from generation to generation, because it is very important for us that we follow something that is alive. My territory as well, still alive. They haven't been able to kill it yet. It's quite resilient. And it's going to survive many other attempts to destroy it in the time to come, but we will still resist it as we are doing it today. And we have done it for the past 5 centuries, you know. So it is key that these things remain alive, because we are living beings and we have to abide by other living phenomena.
I love that you introduce us to the concept of metakuyoyasin, this idea of I am the reflection of my relations. And also the power of understanding our stories, or of knowing our stories, of knowing our names, the names of the places that gave birth to us. Can we talk a little bit about the way these names not only inform how we see, how we walk, but how we co-create with each other, you know, how this co-creates a vision of community that is encompassing, that is based on reciprocity and respect.
As I said, the Lakota saying that I am myself, it says Metakuye Oyasim, which is a beautiful thing because it says I am all my relations. I am a reflection of all my relations. So this means that me as an individual is only as an illusion. And after the Europeans came, they brought with them one of the illusions. Actually, they brought many illusions with them and they imposed them onto us. But one of the illusions that they brought was the illusion of the individual. So, for instance, the Charter of Rights of Canada, which is the constitution of this country, is based on the premise that there is an individual, and this individual has rights that has to demand to the state. You know, we don't believe in that. We think we are persons instead of individuals. And I have challenged my students to actually prove me that the individual exists, you know. But the first thing we have to do to create an individual is to sever him or her from all of its relations. But if you do that, yes, you get an individual. But this individual, how long can it survive without its his or her relations? Not too long, you know. So it's a fallacy. The individual, it's a fallacy. And it is so embedded in our daily activities and our daily talk that we use it without really challenging the notion of the individual. You know, it takes a long reflection and a deep reflection to understand the individual is just an illusion that was imposed onto us for hundreds of years. But the individual doesn't exist. What really exists is the person. Because the person doesn't come alone. The person comes with its parity relation, which is the community. And not only the human community, also the non-human community. You know that in your body, for instance, you have millions of bacteria coexisting with you at the same time in your body. That's already a relationship, a vital relationship for us and also for the bacteria. Fungus, for instance, they are also coexisting at the same time that we are in our bodies. So you also find fungi all over your body because we need each other to coexist. Darwin, he emphasized the notion of competition and the survival of the fittest when he looked at non-humans as individuals. But that's a mistaken perception because he didn't see the other component of life on this planet, which is symbiosis. We couldn't live with all of our relationships with other animals, with other plants, with the trees. So he didn't look at that. He just looked at the competition, the individual part, and the survival of the fittest. And actually, if you look, go to Google and look for any animal, they're going to see that that animal, whatever it is coming with other animals as well. And these other animals, they're fulfilling other functions, like cleaning up the animal from bacteria, from other pests, like the cockroaches, for instance. And they exist with each other. They coexist. They share their existence together, never alone, never individually.
I'm reminded of the way we often talk to each other. When we first met, you said, to be me, I have to walk with others. And I've always been struck by the beauty of that sentence, the beauty of not just the notion of parity, but the way we co-create each other, the way we are constantly in co-creation of one another. And this idea of love as one entry point to all the knowing that it's already inscribed, and you know, its instructions are already all around us in nature, in the animals, and the people that we, you know, that we coexist with. So how do we nurture this way of being in ways that allow us to grow, to be grounded, to free ourselves of paradigms? Because I think one of the ways that we have learned to see the world in the Western way of seeing is to understand the different paradigms, the different ways of seeing, whether it's a capitalist paradigm, whether it's, you know, this idea that money, you know, a particular system of managing financial wealth could possibly be a guiding system for co-creating life, which we have now seen it is not. You know, when we look at the world around the world, almost all of the world is capitalist, and almost everywhere in the world we see devastation, poverty, hunger, wars. So clearly this concept of financial you know, paradigms, or the capitalist paradigm to be specific, has not been a successful way. But when we go back to indigenous ways of knowing, when we go back to our ancestral wisdom, to our teachings, we find something that is organic, that is ever-present, that is living, that is alive and informs us. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about the meaning of those words, because they are not only instructing and guiding us, but they're also reflections of how we can see, how we can co-create, reimagine, and walk in a more gentler way. You talked about the different names we have forgotten, you know, our lands, what colonial power has called Americas is Aviala. What does that term mean? How does it help us inform and inform a new consciousness of who we are?
Yeah, I like your question. And I like that you use a proper word for describing what should be our place on this planet. You said nurture. And actually, in my culture, and in many other mature cultures, there is like a perception of what our place should be in relation to our Mother Earth. And for instance, in my language, Aymara, we say suma khameya, and that means live and coexist well. In Quechua, we say suma causai, which means basically the same thing, live and coexist well. Other cultures, like for instance, the Guarani culture in the Amazon, they say Nyandereko or Ivi Maraye, which means living in the land without evil. In the Anishinaabe Mowin language, we say Mino Bimadisuin, which means being alive well. In Cree, they say Miu Pinitium, which means also like being alive well and in harmony with everything that exists. In Inuktitut, I know I don't pronounce well in Institut, but it's something like it is Kajarnik. That's called it's much more complex than the other things I said, but it means like being in your land in a reflective position and being glad to be there with everything that surrounds you. So they have found other metaphors for that. So it's much difficult to interpret, but I did have some an Inuk elder to interpret this for me, and that's what he told me. And many other mature cultures, they actually have a perception about our place on the circle of life, and it's expressed in many ways, and they basically mean the same thing. That we have to coexist, and we have to be together nurturing our life and the lives of our relations to exist peacefully and prudently on this planet. Because now we are well into the era of the Pachacuti, the cosmic upheaval, where everything is upside down, and that's very easy to demonstrate. Like, for instance, the marketplace, like many hundreds of years ago, was just like an appendix to society, and society always had social control over the market. Whereas nowadays, it's the opposite, it's the total opposite. The most important thing is the market, and the society is just an appendix to the market. The market takes all the decisions about society. So society has become an appendix of the market. And as you mentioned, even more, is not only the market of goods and services, but it is an intangible market, the financial market, that nowadays they are being administered by computers, but not by us anymore. You know, like in 2003, I believe, there was a huge crisis that happened in the financial market, and this crisis was created by computers that initiated the trade at many instances, and they actually managed to create a huge financial crisis. So nowadays, it is artificial intelligence, it is robotics, it's engineering that are trying to go beyond the control of humans and administer themselves by on their own and create their own. You know that Microsoft created a chatbot in the internet, and at the end of the day, once this chatbot was created, they had to bring it down because this chatbot or robot was behaving in a very bad way. It became a bully, it became a very racist chatbot, and it was becoming like a monster, like a Frankenstein, you know, so they had to take it off. And this is happening increasingly so with the advent of that artificial intelligence and with robotics, you know, it's just very scary. So we are losing control over many, many things, you know. And so this is the only time in which we can still do something about the bad things that we have been doing, the forgetfulness that we have entered into. It is still time to remedy this, and the remedy is quite easy. We have to remember the original instructions and to live according to them. And actually, the meaning of Avyayala, it comes from the Kuna language, from the Kuna people. The Kuna people, they live in what is nowadays Panama, but actually they originate in Colombia. But they had to flee Colombia because there was a long war there in Colombia, so they moved to Panama. And an Aymara elder was actually traveling to North America. So he came over here to make contact with his sisters and brothers, because the prophecy said that we were going to meet with each other again in time. So he tried to be more proactive. So he traveled to the back of the turtle. He met the Haudenosaunee Nation. He met many Anishinaabe elders, Inuk elders, and many, many elders from the ones that exist, from the nations that exist here on the back of the turtle. And as he was going back to my country, he decided to do it by land, not to take the airplane. So he visited many, many nations in the U.S. He moved on to Central America, and eventually he ended up in Panama. And that's where he learned that the people there, they called the whole territory Abya Yala. So he asked why, and of course he asked for the meaning of this word, and he learned that Abya Yala means the mature land, because it is inhabited by mature people, which are our indigenous nations. You know, so that's what it means. Abya Yala, it means the mature nation, or also the land in fruition. So all those significances are very beautiful, you know, because you're talking about your land that is bearing fruit already. And that's a very keen observation that our ancestors had about the land. Because like if you plant an apple tree and the tree hasn't lost its original instructions, so eventually that apple tree is going to grow up, it's going to become an apple tree, and eventually it'll start to apple, because that is the original instruction. The same thing, if you have a kitten, eventually it's going to grow up and it's going to become a cat, because that is original instruction. Whereas we as human beings, we need to wear several masks. We have to be doctors, we have to be students, we have to be engineers, we have to be this and that. So we need to be many other masks, because we are afraid, because colonialism, capitalism, and patriarchy, they imbued in us this fear of looking at our own eyes. We are afraid at looking at who we are, but we shouldn't be afraid. We are just humans, and that's what we should be. We should be humans, and that's the only thing that it takes to go to the next step, to be a good human. So in my classes, the message I pass to my students is that if you remember your original instructions, you are going to be a good human. And if you are a good human, to take the next step and to be a good ancestor, it's just a small step that you have to take. But you have to begin somewhere. You have to begin somewhere. You have to begin by abiding by the teachings of the seven grandfathers if you live here on Turtle Island.
Thank you. That was so beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Silvia.
Take care.
Bye.
That was Dr. Marcelo Saavedra. He's a professor in Indigenous Studies at the University of Ottawa.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.